Education Finance Committee to order. And at this point, we do have a quorum. And if I could get Representative Seltzer, have you looked at the minutes?
Yes, I have, Representative, and I would move the minutes.
Representative Seltzer moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And the minutes are moved. The Committee on Education Finance will now take up House File 2. Welcome, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And it's your bill, so I think we'll let you move it. Members, if we do not conclude with this bill prior to 2:30, the committee will recess until 5 o'clock or until the call of the chair here at Room 5. We do have a number of testifiers, and it is the intent to pass this bill today, so to take a vote on it. So just so everyone knows, and remember, this bill's jurisdiction is related to education finance, and I'm sure we'll have some great discussion. And I would ask that we try to keep those questions to the jurisdiction of the bill and that we keep it moving along. So, Representative Loon, if you'd like to move your file.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move House File 2 and that it be, I think the motion is referred to the General Register.
So Representative Loon moves her House File 2 to the General Register. And you have an author's amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. It's the A-20 amendment in the members' packets, I believe.
And would you like to speak to that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll run through fairly briefly the amendment, and I'll try to do it roughly in the order that it comes, so by the page and line numbers, if I could.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So beginning with lines 1.2 through lines 2.24 and 236, and then lines page 3.8 and 312 through 316, and part of this is just the way our statutes and our legislation is written. There's just several references here on the same theme that need to be repeated. But this has to do with clarifications in the skills examination for the MTLE and some changes I'm making. We had a fair amount of discussion in the Education Policy, Innovation and Policy Committee on this, and I did reflect a lot on some of that discussion. And so my bill as originally introduced had required that teacher candidates would take the MTLE skills test, and then if they did not pass, could substitute the ACT or SAT. I'm going to adjust that thinking and the process here with this amendment. So first of all, I make it clear, because there was some discussion, sometimes it's referred to as basic skills and what teachers are required to demonstrate in terms of their academic abilities or knowledge, and it really isn't basic levels. We're talking more on college level skills, and so we just insert the word college level to apply to the skills that we're asking our teacher candidates to be able to demonstrate. So that's a change made throughout the legislation that I'm proposing today. I would also remove the requirement that I had originally put in the legislation requiring a teacher candidate to first attempt to pass the skills examination in reading, writing, and math if they already have sufficient qualifying passing scores from ACT or SAT as an alternative. Continue to authorize teacher candidates that don't have a score in either. They can choose the examination they wish and submit. The licensure via portfolio, just a little clarification there to indicate that the portfolios would still be submitted to the Educator Licensing Division at MDE, at Department of Education, but would require or clarify that the Board of Teaching must notify the portfolio applicant of approval or disapproval, and then to advise a candidate on how to revise a portfolio for resubmission if they were not approved. Again, just trying to clear up sort of the paperwork process. I'm trying to avoid an unintended consequence. I'm shifting the entire portfolio process to the Board of Teaching. Finally, with regards to adjoining states' teacher licensure agreements, we remove a direct reference to the National Association of State Directors of Teacher Education and Certification. It's my understanding the board is already working on that relationship, and that but in order to give them the most flexibility, I'm just not going to list a specific reference to a specific organization or a group, so that they can work with the most flexibility. Community expert waiver, again, another fair amount of discussion over that proposal. And so I'm going to add the language unique and compelling to the rationale that a school district must provide to the Board of Teaching when they're informing them that they have hired somebody using the community expert waiver. So they must have, again, to provide their rationale and why, what their reasoning is for needing to do that. Unrequested leave of absence. These are lines 3.18 through lines or page 4.3 of the amendment. With regards to the reference to effectiveness categories, changing that to be addressing effectiveness categories or ratings. Again, the teacher evaluation model that was developed referenced categories, but all the districts have the flexibility to develop their own systems and have, and not all of them have done it in the same way. So we're trying to be more encompassing, recognizing that one district's process is going to be different from another, and that if there are districts that don't reference effectiveness categories, understanding that that is not inconsistent with the subdivision or with the bill. And then finally, with regards to requests that a little more time be allowed for districts to get through the third and summative year of teacher evaluations, I would push back the effective date of this legislation by 1 year, so to the 2017-18 school year. And I think that's basically it, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Loon. And so to get the bill in the shape the author would like, I'm sorry, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I'm just trying to quickly catch up with the amendment, and I do think it does reflect some of the conversation we had in policy committee. So I appreciate the chair's, adjusting and going along with the bill. But back in the MTLE provision, I didn't see it here, but I just want to make sure in terms of the changes, and I think the changes you made to them are good changes. However, the core of the issue relative to, the big change has to do with the order of the tests that are taken. So that's not changed then, right? In other words, under this language, expectation would still be to take the MTLE test and then, depending on that, be able to opt into the ACT or not.
Representative Loon?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani. No, and let me be a little clearer about that. So my original bill as proposed and when in discussed in policy committee would have required candidates to take the MTLE skills test. If they did not pass, they could substitute the ACT or the SAT is now an option. I have decided to remove the requirement that teacher candidates must take the MTLE, and I'm referring it to now college level skills test, so it's more accurate describing it is. It would still be an option, but I'm not requiring candidates to do that first. And the other thing, which I didn't describe in going through the amendment, but asking, again, the Board of Teaching to look at the ACT and the SAT and make some adjustments in how they develop the cut scores, because there is a little bit of inconsistency there. We now require candidates to pass the specific cut score level for the math portion of the MTLE, for the English and the reading and the writing. So you have to pass each of those components with a minimum level cut score. The ACT is not the same way. It's not scored that way. And so I am asking them to make that consistent. The SAT is, because the SAT has a separate math and reading and writing score, so you have to pass in each of those with a minimum level of proficiency to be considered a passing score. The ACT is a little different, so I'm asking the board to go back and to make that consistent across those test options.
Okay. Representative Mariani, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think those are wise moves, if I may add. Quickly on the community experts variance issue on page 12. So I see the change in terms of the So we're adding the unique and compelling language on line 17. However, and again, this goes to the overall design of the approach here. Is there anything in your amendment, however, that changes the removing from the Board of Teaching that sort of gateway in terms of signing off on community experts, or are we still going with the language that we have in the prior engrossment where it's each school making that decision then filing a report with the Board of Teaching?
Representative Loon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, no, I would still allow the board to go ahead and hire using the community expert waiver, but again, they must provide more information and their rationale to the Board of Teaching with the unique and compelling reason for doing so, and the local district is still required to try to find a licensed teacher to fill that position, and this waiver is only available if they are not able to do so first.
So,
Representative Mariani, follow up.
So, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, just to be clear then, are we reverting back to the Board of Teaching in terms of the gateway through which schools would be accessing the community, the variance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I think you're asking if we're reverting back to the Board of Teaching having to give permission first before it happens.
Yes.
No, I am still with my original proposal, which is empowering local districts to make those decisions, but needing to inform the Board of Teaching of their decision and the reason why.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, just for the clarification of the amendment.
Thank you. And with that, if there's no other questions to this, will Representative Loon renews her motion to adopt the A20 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The A20 is adopted. So you have the bill in the shape that you'd like, Representative Loon, if you'd like to speak to that bill. And then members, then we'll move to testimony, and then we'll get questions after that. So I know we have a lot in front of us, and I ask your patience. Representative Loon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members, and we have some members who are already or have served on policy committee and already heard a lot of this, and other members that haven't. So I'll try to take a middle path here in describing the purpose of the bill and that. And then I think you'll for those who haven't heard this already, we'll get a lot more information from the testifiers coming forward. So House File 2, and again, as amended, really focuses on trying to ensure that we're providing a world-class education for all of our students, and doing that by focusing on quality teaching. And we really have two aspects of that we're looking at here. One is with regards to teacher licensing and how we license our teachers, and the other is teacher retention policies, or what happens in an unrequested leave of absence situation, and whether or not teacher effectiveness is part of that decision making. So first of all, I think it's important and one that we all would hope agree to. It's been referred to, Minnesota's been referred to as having the gold standard of teacher licensure, and that starts with a firm foundation in academic skills, and again, with some of the proposals I'm making in here with regards to how we're testing for those academic skills and having a policy that's consistent across different options of tests that we could administer to have that, I think that helps accomplish that goal. Secondly, increasing access to quality teacher candidates. We have heard from a number of districts. I certainly hear from them every day in my capacity as chair of this committee, but about teacher shortages. And not only in specific licensure areas where some of those shortages are more acute, but just various parts of the state. They're having a real hard time attracting teacher candidates and quality. And so, you know, we are really, I'm giving a directive to the Board of Teaching to establish and publish rules by January 1st of 2016 for processes to encourage regional licensure reciprocity, to streamline the alternative pathways for teaching, and again, to really reinstate or reemphasize some methods, such as the portfolio method, which was still in statute but really had been deactivated, if you will, by the department, is an option we expect to be that teachers would, our candidates would be able to follow, and is something that would be a viable licensure option for qualified candidates. With regards to some of the other things, you know, I've talked about those kind of extensively in the amendment, so I won't get into that too deeply. But I think, you know, just a comment on some of the testimony we've heard in policy committee, as well as sort of some of the concerns that have been raised. We want high standards for our teachers, and we want the best possible teachers for our students in Minnesota. But some of our licensure process, from the stories specifically that we've heard of teachers who have been licensed in a number of other states, come to Minnesota with many years of experience, with lauded evaluations and recommendations from principals, and that having a very difficult time getting licensed in Minnesota, and having to jump through hoops that just really seem rather extraordinary. So, again, we just want to make sure that we have a transparent, clear, logical, and understandable process for qualified candidates to get through the licensure, and one that is not too difficult. I think one from the ability to look at the requirements and to know exactly what it is they need to do to be licensed in Minnesota, and that there's not a question or an arbitrariness to how that process is to proceed. Secondly, moving to the other portion of the bill, which has to do with unrequested leave of absence, or many people refer to it as the LIFO, or last in, first out provision. I am proposing that teacher evaluations be part of that process, but other factors such as seniority, which is specifically listed in the bill, or other things that a local district would like to be included, that we would no longer have sort of a default policy in state statute that says it's seniority, but I would be asking every district to have a negotiated plan on what would happen if there's an unrequested leave of absence that happens in their districts, of how they would determine which teachers would be laid off. Again, this is an attempt to say that we have a very valuable tool that's been created, a bipartisan effort in the legislature, one that our school districts and their teachers have embraced because they have created it together in each district of across the state of Minnesota. Those evaluations are now in the first year of being in place. They're going on. And with the change and pushing out the effective date, we will have 3 full years of evaluations in place, including that 3-year summative evaluation. And I feel strongly that that is important information. We know from a number of surveys and public opinion polls that have been taken that parents expect that effectiveness and merit is going to be part of the decision when considering which teachers would be retained if your school is going to lay off teachers. And so I think this is a logical thing. This is not about a punitive measure to get rid of ineffective teachers. And some of those comments have been made that this is not a process for that. And that is not the intent of the bill. The teacher evaluation process is really the tool of which evaluating teacher skills, mentoring them, providing them professional development, suggestions for improvement. Having a negotiated process on deciding which teachers you can keep if you cannot afford to keep them all, or if you have fewer students than you anticipated having, for whatever reason that a district has to go into this process. It's knowing that there is a process in place that allows your school district to keep their best teachers. And that's really what this is about, making sure that our students have the best possible teachers in their classrooms. And that's what we want for all of our kids. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think the committee members would like to hear from the testifiers, and I'd be happy to entertain questions when we get to that.
And thank you, Representative Loon. I think that was a nice presentation. We have 13 testifiers at this point, so in the interest of time, what I'd like to do is have three of you come up at once, and then the rest can be on deck. And so Angie Rosner, is that correct? I want to make sure I get the names right. So it's Rosner. And then David Aaron and Jess Anna Glover with Education Minnesota, and Kitty Ford with MACTE. So those three first. And when you come up, Ms. Rosner, just state your name and begin your testimony for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angie Rosner, and I live and teach in Eden Prairie. And I am here to share my concerns regarding House File 2. I am a math teacher in Eden Prairie and have been a QComp coach observer, as well as a member of our district QComp committee. Our district has in place a process for observing teachers on our 10 recommended standards that the district actually recommends, and we observe each teacher on those 10 standards. If a teacher is found not proficient on any of the standards that they are given, professional development and coaching is provided to improve their practice. Our goal is to assist each teacher in improving so that that teacher can show proficiency. We do the same thing with each and every child that we teach. We help them to show that they can be successful, and we go in with positive intentions as we work with each and every child. We work with teachers who need to improve. We consult with our administrators, who are our educational leaders within our building. We do have a process in place to assure due process for each teacher if they need interventions from our administrators. An administrator is free to come into a classroom each and every day. They can come in unannounced. They can work with a teacher who needs improvement. We have coaches in place to help. We have mentors in place to help teachers. Our goal is always to have the best teacher in each and every classroom. I want you to also know that I am co-chair of our Teacher Development and Evaluation Committee, and we worked tirelessly the entire year to come up with a good plan to help Eden Prairie Schools. We believe that this plan was all about evaluating teachers in the area of student achievement, student engagement, and classroom performance. Never once was a discussion that this plan was intended to provide a layoff process for teachers. It was always to talk about how do we help teachers to develop and improve their skill set as they go forward. We talked a lot about how to support teachers in each one of these areas, and during this process we had long discussions about what was the final piece going to look like. We talked about, should it be proficiency, should it be not proficiency, or should it be a score? Should we say that this teacher is a 42, this teacher is a 98, this teacher is a 66? What we had to do was come up with what is our best way of evaluating teachers so that the discussion would be fruitful between the administrator and the teacher. And what we landed on was an idea of proficiency and non-proficiency. So the discussion talked about how do we help each teacher to improve versus just talking about a number. We really focused on the skill set that was needed for each teacher to improve, and that was an important part of what we did. I want you to know that I also was a negotiator for our last contract. And never once during our negotiation process did the process of layoff come to the table. We all agreed that the best process that we use is our seniority process, and that we have a due process in place for each teacher, that if we are concerned about how a teacher is being successful within the classroom, our administrators work with those teachers. And I think that our teacher development and evaluation process just got started, and we need to give it an opportunity to see how it's going to develop and help teachers to improve their skills. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about what we are experiencing and what I am personally experiencing in Eden Prairie. And I just hope that you will look at these concerns as you are considering House File 2. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Rosner, correct, Ms. Rosner? Well, and thank you very much. And so you had mentioned a math teacher and also part of the negotiations team. Any other capacity that you have that may be helpful for the community to know your background?
I've been a teacher. This is my 30th year in Eden Prairie School, so I have longevity in the area. I have been very involved in a number of capacities of working with at-risk students as well as honor students, and so have been involved. I also serve as our teacher union president in Eden Prairie, so I've been very involved in all facets of helping to advocate for teachers, but mostly helping to advocate for the students in Eden Prairie so that they can be successful and go on to a post-high school situation that they can be as successful as possible.
Very good, and thank you very much. And I'm almost always very nervous in front of math teachers, but today you're very comfortable, so thank you.
Thank you very
much. If you
much.
Could take a seat behind in case you need to come up for testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. And so the next one, so David Aaron and Jess Ann Glover and Kitty Ford. Is that all with Education Minnesota? Is that correct?
No,
I'm sorry, just David Aaron and Jess Ann Glover. So we'll bring you both up together if we could. And Derek Olson, if you could be ready to come up, you're number three. Okay. And if you could state your name for the record and your testimony. And if you could follow Ms. Rosner's lead, she was very concise and to the point, so she set the stage very nicely.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is David Aaron. I am a staff attorney at Education Minnesota and also a former high school special education teacher. I've spoken to some of you in the policy committee about Education Minnesota's concerns regarding the licensure provisions in House File 2. We'll try not to be too repetitive, but there are some points I'd like to stress. I'd like actually to start by thanking this committee and Representative Loon for the changes to the MTLE portion of House File 2, specifically eliminating the requirement that licensure candidates first must take the MTLE skills tests before being able to use a qualifying SAT or ACT score. I believe that that is in the spirit of the changes that were made last year, and we are very encouraged by that. Second, our members still do have other concerns with licensure provisions in House File 2. We do still feel that it proposes to lower standards for teachers licensed in other states to receive licenses in Minnesota. While we do support giving the Board of Teaching greater flexibility, accepting preparation programs from other states that might not match up identically to those in Minnesota, this bill still takes reciprocity too far, in our opinion. Given the dramatically lower standards for teacher preparation programs in some states, not all states, but some states, the provision that would allow any program to transfer into a Minnesota license would allow individuals to teach in our schools despite coming from a state that has that requires far less experience, training, and content knowledge than Minnesota requires. We believe that we can recruit talented and successful teachers from other parts of this country without lowering licensure standards to the point that anyone licensed in any state can automatically become licensed in Minnesota. I'd also like to call your attention to Section 8 of House File 2, which removes the requirement that school districts must have the Board of Teaching's approval to hire a non-licensed community expert. We do believe that community experts should be hired for unique and compelling reasons, but without the board's oversight, we are concerned that districts will be hiring community experts for the wrong reasons in some cases. So we definitely support continuing to have the Board of Teaching making that final call over whether a community expert is hired. Finally, I wanted to point out something I didn't point out in the policy committee, which is that under current law, community experts are not covered by the teacher development and evaluation law. So this bill would actually increase the number of individuals working in our schools who are not subject to the evaluation and accountability measures that this legislature put in place and that Education Minnesota has supported. If there are flaws in the current system for approving non-licensed community experts or teachers licensed in other states, let's work together to fix those. Let's also, since this is the Finance Committee, I'm requesting that we also make sure that we provide adequate funding.
And Mr. Aaron, if I could add, I know you have a couple of testifiers, if you could wrap it up so we get to the other.
Yes. But it's essential that we provide adequate funding to the Board of Teaching so that they have the staff and the resources to approve these candidates licensed in other states. So I've asked the authors of House File 2 to work with us, with the Board of Teaching and other stakeholders, to make reforms that will increase flexibility without lowering standards to obtaining a Minnesota teaching license.
And thank you for the testimony. And thank you, Mr. Aaron. And Ms. Glover.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jessanna Glover, and I'm an attorney with Education Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to provide testimony on the proposed changes to the teacher layoff provisions of House File 2. Our four main issues are, one, it is not needed. Principals have all the tools they need to remove ineffective teachers, and they should not wait until layoffs to get rid of bad teachers. Number two, school districts and local teachers can already negotiate this. Number three, this bill may lead to costly legal challenges. And number four, this bill is just not good for students. We all know a bad teacher. Mine was Mr. Erickson. He sat at his desk and gave us vocabulary words, and we spent the class periods looking them up. That's the bad teacher, right? That's the narrative. But the narrative around what the bad teacher has ended, reality for Mr. Erickson would have changed because of the teacher development and evaluation law. He probably wasn't evaluated, but today, a teacher like him must be evaluated, must improve, and if they're unwilling or unable to improve, the district must discipline or discharge him. That's what the law says. That's how you changed teacher quality a few years ago. It is the most dramatic shift in teacher quality that is happening right now. The 2011 TDE law was created to improve teachers and create a culture of growth and benefit for the students. By creating a direct link between evaluation and layoff, this bill changes the purpose of evaluation from improvement to competition. That will make every teacher's employment dependent on not just being good or great for themselves as an individual, but on being better than their colleagues. Research from the private sector uses of effectiveness rankings supports the conclusion that they're bad for employee morale and business outcomes. Medtronic, Microsoft, Cargill have all abandoned this model. Effectiveness categories could do the same in schools. They will create competition between staff. Teachers may be less willing to accept challenging students in their classrooms. Experienced teachers may be less likely to mentor newer teachers. Teachers may simply be less willing to share or less willing to help struggling colleagues become better teachers. A culture of collaboration and growth to improve student learning. That is the greatest promise of TDE. Districts and local teachers can already incorporate performance measures into their layoff systems and TDE plans if they want to. About 40% of Minnesota school districts have locally negotiated layoff language that go beyond seniority. And all but approximately 10 districts have locally crafted TDE plans. House File 2 would force everyone to review and possibly redo their TDE plans, as well as negotiate new layoff language, regardless of what they have already agreed was best for their unique districts. House File 2 does not provide a way for teachers to prove their effectiveness category compared to their peers. And because effectiveness categories are private personnel data on individual teachers, the system is not transparent.
And Ms. Glover, I'd ask you to wrap up if you can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Teachers are concerned with bias, quality of evaluators, and administrators playing favorites. Layoffs will lead to legal challenges. Money spent on attorneys is not money spent on students. Layoff based on license and seniority provides a predictable, reliable, and credible layoff system for a district. It's an especially good layoff system for a district that uses tool like evaluation and discharge. There's nothing in House File 2 that will improve the quality of teaching and learning in Minnesota schools, which is tragic given all the needs our students bring into the classroom today.
And thank you, Ms. Glover. And members, just so you know, I'm Between the educator, the teacher that started, and the lawyers, we've been at about 2.5 minutes before I ask you to wrap up. And the reason is to keep us moving so that as we solicit questions, we can bring you back up. So I'm not trying to rush anybody's testimony, but I want to be fair to everybody that at the 2.5 mark, that's when you'll hear from me. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if Kitty Ford. And then Roger Arneson, you'll be number three. So, and after Kitty is Derek Olson. And if the pages could help distribute the materials, that'd be helpful. And the Board of Teaching, excuse me. And Kitty, I believe you have the Board of Teaching. I'm sorry, Miss Ford, you have the Board of Teaching with you. Is that correct?
Testifying only on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education.
Okay. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Ford, and if you'd state your name for the record.
My name is Kathleen Ford, and I am the president of the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. I'm also an educator of approximately 39 years, 29 years in public schools in Lakeville, Minnetonka, and administrator in Chaska. And now I am a professor at the Minnesota State University in Mankato. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. We offer this document that is being circulated, profession ready, prepared, effective, and accountable, to inform deliberations on House File 2, and think that you will find that it provides evidence of uniform, thorough, and transparent quality throughout the state based upon rigorous Minnesota standards, which is our mutual responsibility as indicated in the Minnesota State Constitution. Page 2 of the document provides evidence of how Minnesota prepared teachers are uniformly prepared to provide effective and equitable instruction to all Minnesota students. Page 3 provides evidence of the multiple measures that assure that Minnesota prepared teachers have met rigorous standards and are profession ready. Page 4 provides evidence of the consistent, transparent, and public measures used by the Board of Teaching and teacher preparation to assure accountability. This document is offered in evidence of the fact that we do have consistent, accountable regulations and rules based on rigorous standards that are used to make sure that every student in every classroom has a well-qualified teacher. MACT has one overarching recommendation for further consideration during your deliberations. All teacher candidates should be held to the same high standards for licensure that are reflected in the requirements of Minnesota statute and rulemaking by the Board of Teaching, and as such also represent the broad consensus of what Minnesota teachers should know and be able to do. We specifically suggest the following actions should be considered. Action number one, we're happy that you and agree with the amendment that permits the MTLA test to not have to be taken before we can use the ACT-SAT. That is a marvelous amendment. Thank you very much for making that. However, there is language in that amendment that might be of concern and have impact. Correlation studies this fall between the ACT and the MTLE basic skills indicated that in order for 50% of the candidates to pass the MTLE, they would need an ACT score of 23.4. For 60% of the candidates to pass, they'd need a score of 22. And for 80% of the candidates to pass, they'd need a score of 21. It isn't just that we can set language that says essentially equivalent passing scores. We have a supply problem based on the MTLE basic skills test, reducing supply in outstate Minnesota and internally to our diverse candidates. We need to have cleaner, clearer language about how that passing rate will be set.
And Ms. Ford, just so you know, we're at the mark.
Action two, the clarity of licensing processes needs to match standards. Ensure that all licensed teachers complete licensure requirements based on Minnesota standards. Making requirements to meet standards flexible for either the Board of Teaching or for districts to license and hire candidates who are prepared outside of Minnesota, unlicensed CTE teachers, or for non-licensed community experts does not assure uniform effective teachers for all students, nor does it assure equity of opportunity for our teacher candidates seeking employment. Please do address the factors that are actually contributing to the hiring problems in outstate Minnesota. And finally, action three, allow the Board of Teaching to continue with their steady progress in developing state-by-state reciprocity agreements where they are appropriate. Legislating flexible standards for out-of-state licensure in 122A.23 subdivision 2 prevents the Board of Teaching from assuring that the rigor of a license from other states is commensurate with the rigor of Minnesota teaching licensure requirements. Experience in passing a few tests is insufficient evidence of meeting rigorous standards for my grandchildren. Allow the time and authority needed to assure consistent teaching quality for all Minnesota students. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ford. And Mr. Olson, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
Derek Olson.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I live in Stillwater, Minnesota. I have co-authored research on teacher quality and effectiveness, and I am currently working on my dissertation on teacher evaluation. I teach courses in the Graduate Department of Education at University of Wisconsin River Falls, and I was honored in 2008 to be named the Minnesota Teacher of the Year. More importantly, I've been teaching elementary school in Minnesota public schools for the last 24 years, first in St. Louis Park and now in Stillwater. Most importantly, I am the parent of three children enrolled in public schools in this great state. Above all other reasons I may have for being here today, number one is to assure that my kids have great teachers. Research is clear. We all agree on that. Quality teachers matter. But how we get there is where I differ with this bill and with Representative Lynn. I have several grave concerns. I'm concerned about taking a TDE plan, one intended to develop teacher quality and evaluate a teacher's growth, and instead use it in ways it was not intended, to make high-stakes decisions by attempting to rate teachers in order to determine unrequested leave. First, there's the issue of reliability and validity. The TDE plans are not adequately designed to determine this task. The actual title of my dissertation is, and excuse me, is long and boring, Award-Winning Teachers: Perspectives on the Characteristics of Teacher Quality as Reflected in Charlotte Danielson's Framework for Teaching. I mention this because Danielson's Framework for Teaching is the teaching evaluation observation tool that forms the basis for the Minnesota State default TDE plan. In fact, it's the most commonly used observation tool not only in the state but in the country and is used worldwide. I've spent much of the past 3 years familiarizing myself with research on teacher quality and teacher evaluation and on Danielson's framework specifically, and have gotten to know her. So after hearing last Friday's testimony and understanding, in my opinion, the potential negative impact of this bill, I called Charlotte to find her thoughts on the evaluations based on her tool being used in this way. She called me right back. She had serious concerns. The devil's in the details, she told me in her British accent, and pointed out that if this bill goes forward in the current state of things, she predicts that in no time there will be a flood of legal cases of released teachers with strong arguments that a system with little reliability or validity using scores that would not stand up to the statistical analysis were used to make high-stakes decisions. Again, this is the opinion of the creator of that tool herself. There are many recent studies that demonstrate the extreme difficulty in correlating summative teacher evaluations with actual teacher quality and student achievement. These studies range from the Large Measures of Effective Teaching study, the largest of its kind, which analyzed thousands of teachers, to the work of experts like Linda Darling Hammond. I would be happy to prepare at a later time a bibliography of some of these articles.
And Mr. Olson, just to let you know, you're at the mark.
All right, thank you. Just one more point. Secondly, I am concerned that using TDE plans to make high-stakes decisions, such as determining the rank order of unrequested leaves, will actually decrease the factors that lead to increased teacher quality, which is the exact opposite of our shared goal of making all teachers better. Research, including some research I co-authored, which I'd be happy to share, indicates that teacher collaboration in the forms of things like mentoring, professional learning communities, are the very things that make teachers better. So why would we implement a high-stakes decision-making process that will actually increase competition between teachers and decrease collaboration, the very thing that increases quality? I believe that every parent in this room, Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, wants the best for their child, and that includes a great teacher. Therefore, before you consider a bill that would endorse making high-stakes decisions like releasing teachers using evaluation tools that weren't designed for that purpose, I ask you to look closely at the research and not to confuse politics with logic, emotion with facts, and wishful thinking with reality. Thank you very much. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And thank you for your testimony, Ms. Olson. If you want to make those materials available, the pages can certainly distribute that. And if you can stay around for questions, I'm sure that'd be helpful as well.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Mr. Arneson and the Board of Teaching and Ms. Hayes are the next three. And welcome to the committee. We see you quite a bit.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you very much. I'm Roger Arneson. I represent the elementary and the secondary school principals, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify here. I did testify in the policy committee as well. And I do think many of the technical aspects of this bill were well vetted in the policy committee. It appeared to me that the members really did get into a lot of the details. A few things just to bring up that the school principals would like you to take into consideration as you review this bill. There are a lot of positive aspects in this bill in the way that it is constructed. It gives a significant amount of discretion locally to school boards and to the teachers' unions. I know we're spending an awful lot of time talking about the position of evaluation in the unrequested leave layoff, but the bill doesn't assign any weight to the evaluations in that particular decision-making process. That's something that's going to be designed locally, and I think if we had all the groups together and said we had to do this, we would want to give local school boards as much discretion with their teachers' unions to design these systems as possible. There's a wonderful quote that I found in a 1986 Supreme Court decision about the Teacher Tenure Act in Minnesota. And it talked about balancing two key factors, which is why you're struggling with this so much. They said the legislature has stated a clear intent to protect senior teachers. That's what the Teacher Tenure Act is about. We're talking about layoffs. There's a clear intent to protect senior teachers. The legislature has also enunciated a policy that we want to give school boards the maximum flexibility as they're running their districts. And so the problem for all of you is to balance those two factors as they come together. A couple things that you should be aware of in here. There is a Data Practices Act problem, as we've talked about a little bit, and that is the challenging of these evaluations in a Data Practices Act challenge. And as the bill goes on, maybe we can take care of that in another committee. There's a case that came down from the Supreme Court last year about police officers challenging their evaluations and then getting hearings through the Office of Administrative Hearings. And if we're going to do this particular model, we certainly would want to avoid giving everyone an opportunity to litigate their evaluation again in that particular area. And we could take care of that, and I would say to you, we have talked about this in the legal community as well, that even if we weren't doing this, we'd be talking to you about closing off that avenue of going out there and litigating the evaluations out there. When I testified in the policy committee, I had mentioned that I think there was a problem here about how do we get this done. It is a major success in K-12 that we negotiated local evaluations in this evaluation tool. You told us we either negotiated them locally or we would get the state model, and we negotiated in almost every district a local model. If you think back some years ago, you said if you'll negotiate and the teachers will join in the grant application, we can approve QCOMP grants. You set that up in that fashion. People negotiated these locally, put the grants together, we came to those agreements. I think we can do this if you give us the push on this to negotiate these plans locally, but we do need some sort of little carrot or stick or whichever model you want to go on the end there, Mr. Chair, something to push us along, because some of these negotiation sessions, if this is the only issue, that we could get strung out there a bit.
And Mr. Arneson, yeah. We're at the mark.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think maybe I'll wrap it up there. That might be a good time, and I'll be around, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with the committee.
I appreciate the testimony. Thank you very much. And so let's go to the Board of Teaching representative, and then to Ms. Hayes, and then Ms. Cragthorpe, if I have that correct, is on deck. And please state your name for the record, and I'll start the testimony on the clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Erin Doan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Just a couple of comments for you today. Our testimony for policy committee was quite lengthy, so I think just follow up at this point.
I'm sorry if I could. Can I get the name again so I make sure I get that correct?
Sure. It's Erin, and the last name is Doan.
Thank you. Okay.
The first point of clarification that I would like to offer, as we've heard a lot of testimony for candidates saying, I have contacted the BOT, and I have not been able to get an answer out of them. One of the things that I'd like you to know about the way that licensure is structured in the state of Minnesota is that there are really two agencies that are at the helm for managing the licensing process. While the Board of Teaching is responsible for setting policy for licensure decision-making, the Department of Education's Division of Educator Licensing does the review and issuance of teacher licenses. That's important for a couple of reasons, only because what I want you to know is that it's confusing, and it's confusing to candidates on the outside. What we have really focused on in the last year especially is really cleaning up some communication issues that we're having. When people want to contact the Board of Teaching for licensure appeal, we want to make sure that they find the Board of Teaching and that they're not placing calls to educator licensing and re-engaging in an application process. So as you can see, it's really not as simple as getting an answer, one direct answer from the Board of Teaching when you're not even sure who you're calling. I would like to thank you for a couple of changes in the proposed amendment. So first, for the ability for candidates to have choice in the exam that they're taking for demonstration of skills, in addition to the changes that have been made to the licensure via portfolio component. It does make good sense that those continue to be submitted to educator licensing, just as all other license applications are. So thank you for that. Finally, I just want to clarify there have been a number of folks who have testified about jumping through hoops, and we heard that again today about jumping through hoops that seem extraordinary. For the majority of teachers who come to Minnesota holding a license in other states, when they come to Minnesota, they're issued a one-year license with the requirement to complete some jurisdictional specific items. Three of those items are testing, a skills exam, a content exam, and a pedagogy exam, all three which reside in statute at this point. They also are given the opportunity to complete a human relations requirement, learning about multicultural education, if they do not, already bring that with them. And their institution that's recommending them or their licensure program coming forward is allowed to verify that they've done that. And then finally, scientifically based reading instruction. This is one of the components that we hear the most about for teachers who are coming to Minnesota. The legislature focused in the last 4 years primarily on raising the standards for reading instruction for Minnesota candidates, and this piece specifically we are looking for keeping the same expectation for candidates coming from out of state as those who are receiving their instruction and their training in Minnesota. And finally, developmentally appropriate teaching methods. We would like to ensure that all candidates who receive teacher licensure and are in Minnesota classrooms understand how to teach their content in developmentally appropriate ways. The last piece that I would like to offer is just a lever that no one has really talked about at this point, at least not publicly. Candidates who are arriving in Minnesota from other states who hold licenses that don't match the Minnesota scope, for instance, someone who is coming with...
And just a reminder, Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Someone who is coming to Minnesota with a 612 license in a content area may come to Minnesota and be asked to complete elementary-specific training. They're issued a restricted license, and they're allowed 3 years for that elementary-specific training to continue. One of the options that could be considered is to allow them more time to meet Minnesota requirements or to continue teaching within the original license level that they were issued in that state. And I know it's a very fast testimony to try and cover some very in-the-weeds details, but I'm happy to answer questions on that moving forward. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
And thank you, Ms. Doan, right?
That's right.
Thank you. And just so everyone understands what my intentions are, at 2:30, we are going to go to recess. I'd love to get all the questionings through by 2, or the testifiers, so that we can have robust questioning and not break it up. But if we can't, I understand as well. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to allow the members so that if anybody has to leave, that we can respect that. So thank you. And Ms. Hayes. And after Ms. Hayes, Ms. Cragthorpe and Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District, And I want to speak specifically to the teacher applicants from out of state. As you probably know, a big part of what we do is hiring special education teachers. And you all know that the market for special ed teachers is very, very tight across the state. Trying to find candidates who will work in our level 4 special ed programs is even tighter. I think I'll make my testimony a little bit shorter based on some of the comments we just heard.
And the chair appreciates
it. Two things that we would like the committee to consider, and to the extent that this bill addresses these two things, we would be in support. Number one, please find a way to create some better reciprocity for the testing between states. The example that you have in front of you talks about a particular teacher we hired this year who in 1 year has to jump through a number of hoops, cost him about $2,000. If he were to go the other direction, he clearly would not have to be spending as much money to go into Wisconsin from Minnesota. But probably even more important than changing any of those, if the legislature could find a way to give these teachers more time to meet the requirements that Minnesota has, that would help our out-of-state teachers immensely. When they come to Minnesota and particularly jump into our level 4 special ed programs, they're adapting to a very difficult student population. They're getting used to being in Minnesota, learning our system, and then to have an enormous list of requirements that they have to meet is probably more than many of them even want to do, and we do lose quite a few candidates because of that. So we would propose that you provide an opportunity for a 3-year license for these out-of-state teacher candidates. We're obviously not released from our teacher and evaluation requirements, and so would certainly send someone on the way if they were not performing during those 3 years. So I guess my biggest recommendation is to consider allowing these teachers that come from out of state 3 years to meet the requirements, whatever they might be post-legislation here, to meet Minnesota requirements. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for an opportunity to testify.
And thank you. You have the record so far. And so just one quick thing, if you could let us know who you represent and the capacity. I didn't catch that, and I want to make sure everyone did.
Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District.
And your capacity with Northeast Metro?
Superintendent, thank you.
Thank you. Very good. And Ms. Cragthorpe, and then followed by Mr. Amoroso, and I believe I have this right because I've heard it a couple times, Ms. Radosevich. Go ahead and state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Holly Cragthorpe, and I'm a Minneapolis Public Schools teacher currently on leave of absence. I'm a 14-year veteran teacher, and prior to taking a leave of absence, I was a union steward at my school. I am also the parent of two elementary-age school children. Currently, I serve as an advocacy fellow for Educators for Excellence, which is a teacher-led organization that works locally to elevate the teaching profession, bring teacher voices like mine to the policy table, and increase student achievement. Our Minnesota chapter currently represents 1,000 members. Two teacher policy groups at our Minnesota chapter have convened during the last year and a half to research case studies in the areas of quality compensation and teacher diversity. The teacher diversity policy team met this past fall during evenings after school for 6 weeks, where they reviewed research and case studies on how to best recruit, support, and retain teachers of color. As a Minnesota student for my K-12 education, my post-baccalaureate teaching license, my master's degree, and some coursework in a doctoral program, I cannot recall ever having one single teacher of color. I never had the opportunity to have a teacher of color for a role model, never encountered a classroom other than a white-normed one, and I have spent 14 years teaching in urban schools that were ran mostly by white females. I've rarely had the experience of a person of color having authority over me, and I imagine that you all could say the same. 20 years after I graduated from high school, my neighborhood school today in South Minneapolis has one teacher of color. After years of institutionalized racism, Minnesota schools need a huge shift in teacher workforce demographics. As we face increasing racial tensions in our nation, we urgently need teachers to reflect the communities they serve. Contrary to what some people argue, diversity trainings and the election of an African-American president are simply not enough. Today I'm here to share recommendations on how House File 2 and other bills can help increase teacher diversity, and there are some recommendations being passed out right now. I will be referring to data that is referenced in the notes section of a new report written by teachers, and this is a policy paper that will be launched this Saturday at our Summit for Equity and Teacher Diversity, and I can follow up with you after Saturday if you'd like a copy. We know that as our student population continues to become more diverse, attrition rates for teachers of color also continue to grow, and that nationally, teachers of color are more likely to leave teaching than their white counterparts. Sadly, retention has proven to be an even greater challenge than recruitment and preparation. Many high school and college students of color do not see teaching as a desirable profession for a number of reasons, including the lack of prestige associated with our profession, low starting salaries with few opportunities for significant increases until late in the career track, negative experiences in the K-12 school system, a lack of role models for teachers of color, and the cost barriers that are associated with teacher preparation programs. We are asking you to consider taking new approaches to teacher preparation in order to increase the variety of pathways into our profession. First, we ask the state to require teacher preparation programs to publicly report information on teacher candidate outcomes, such as those outlined in House File 246. We support this bipartisan bill, and we are working on amending it to include a requirement for teacher prep program data to be disaggregated by race. Secondly, we ask the state to fund the expansion of school or community-based teacher preparation pathways such as portfolios, residencies, grow your own programs, and that those programs specifically outline strategies for recruiting and supporting teachers of color. What is most applicable in House File 2 is that our members also advocate for streamlining the out-of-state licensure process so that barriers are removed for qualified teachers from other states in order to expand the pool of teachers from diverse backgrounds, including these three things: teachers who have taught out of state for 3 years who meet testing requirements and coursework, teachers who can demonstrate a proven track record of superior achievement through evaluations or value-added measures, and nationally board certified teachers.
And just to keep you on time,
we are working to support reforms in teacher licensure through this bill as well as House File 589. We welcome your feedback and questions, and we'll work with you this session on select solutions to narrow Minnesota's achievement gap. Thank you for hearing our recommendations today.
And thank you, Ms. Cragthorpe. And just quickly, if I could ask, how old are your kids?
I have an 11-year-old as of today, and I have an 8-year-old.
Oh, well, congratulations. And to be sensitive to that, would you be able to come back for testimony tonight? Or I want to make sure that if you have questions today, that we get those out of the way before we recess at 2:30.
I could come back if needed.
Okay. And we'll ask you at the end, I'll ask the members just to be sensitive to. You have a birthday party to attend.
Thank you, yes.
So, thank you very much. And Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Many of the things we want to chat about have been discussed. We talked.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Amoroso. I was just thinking, members, if we all want to attend the birthday party, we could be done at 2:30. I'm sorry, Mr. Amoroso.
No problem.
I had to throw that in.
I like cake and ice cream. It's okay. Just want to share a couple thoughts very, very quickly in regards to the unrequested leave of absence provision. Want to thank the author for making some of the changes that have been made and that have been approved by the committee. Again, I want to emphasize from our association's perspective that the provision on unrequested leave of absence is a way to maintain and to make sure we have the most effective teachers in our classrooms. You know, I've heard from time to time during the discussion that this is a way to eliminate ineffective teachers. That would be an inappropriate use, in my opinion, of this statute. A district that would wait until they needed to do the implementation of the statute to work with an ineffective teacher is not doing their job. That is why we have a powerful TD&E system that has been created by the legislature that was bargained at the local level throughout the state, and I believe will create great results for our state. And so we're embracing the fact that we believe and we have confidence in our teachers, we have confidence in our administrators, our school boards, that we could, if directed, work together to create an unrestricted leave of policy that would work within the system. And so we embrace that concept of local control. We think that's the way to go. We agree with one of the earlier testifiers that as with teacher development evaluation, there was the alternate that would be required by statute if the two parties, the union and the board, could not come together. And I would think that you might need that type of stick also, or depending on your perspective. But I believe in local control. I have faith in our educators and our boards and our administrators to get the job done. And once again, I want to emphasize, this is not a way to eliminate ineffective teachers. This is a way to maintain, under challenging situations, the most effective teachers. And we all know that the most effective teachers will have an impact on student achievement. Research is very clear about that. So with that, I'll stop at this point and would stand for any questions later on. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Very good. Members, we have five on the list, so we're moving right along. Ms. Radosevich, Mr. Bartholomew, and Ms. Silvine. I hope I have that right. Ms. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Radosevich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Radosevich, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber is the state's largest business membership organization with over 2,300 member businesses statewide. I want to speak very briefly. I'll try to beat the record here. Overall, we're very supportive of House File 2. There are several provisions that I want to mention to you specifically. And we think the bill overall will help to strengthen our K-12 system and help more students prepare for college and career. First, the Chamber is supportive of the provisions to improve the pathway for out-of-state teachers to gain a Minnesota teaching license. We've heard compelling testimony on that already. Accelerated pathways for licensure offer an additional tool to districts that are struggling to close the achievement gap or to fill specialty positions. We welcome the author's effort to bring this to a more full, transparent, and clear implementation. The Chamber is also supportive of the provisions to make performance a component of district decision-making in times of layoffs. We have a teacher evaluation system in place right now. It should be part of the decision-making process for districts, because districts should be using available tools to keep the best teachers in front of students, even in hard times, and not to the exclusion of other considerations such as tenure, but at least as one factor in the overall decision. There are two components of House File 2 that have received less attention, so I want to spend just a moment on those. First is the variance for non-licensed community experts to teach now with unique and compelling needs or reasons without seeking approval of the Board of Teaching. Second is the license requirement exemption for someone who teaches in a part-time vocational or career and technical education program. From the Chamber's perspective, these two provisions help ensure that students gain exposure to a broader range of course and career options while they're in high school. Community experts can fill in where licensed teachers are unavailable to keep course options from being discontinued. Career and technical course offerings will help some students find a career path that is right for them more quickly and affordably than they would be able to do otherwise. Both of these tools would help schools more fully serve the diverse interests within their student population and better prepare more students for college and career. Thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 2.
And thank you, Ms. Radosevich. Very good. Under time. Mr. Bartholomew, followed by Ms. Silvine and Ms. Dietrich, former Representative Dietrich.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew, and I've been scratching out lines from my testimony, so I think I'll ad-lib a little bit as well. And I'll just to quickly say I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we support House File 2 and ask that you would adopt it as well. Overall, House File 2 will make it easier for our schools to ensure our students have the best teachers in their classrooms. We also support the accelerated pathways to licensure provisions in the bill. One of these is a follow-up to something the legislature passed in 2011, when as part of that alternative pathways bill, we directed the board to create streamlined opportunities for out-of-state teachers to transfer into Minnesota. That clearly hasn't happened yet, and 5 years later, a deadline of January of 2016 certainly seems appropriate. We're also supportive of the licensure via portfolio options, It's an intensive process, but candidates did choose it. And equally important to the provisions in this bill that help attract high-quality teachers to our classroom is giving school boards the ability to retain their talented teachers. And unfortunately, under current law, in the absence of a locally negotiated alternative, state law requires districts to lay off teachers in unrequested leave strictly by seniority. This is something they can't consider a performance metric, unlike other employers. And I just wanted to anticipate a question in Policy Committee. Representative Seltzer asked about other employers. I've had a chance to talk to some. As a follow-up, there are a variety of models for employee evaluations. In the one company you had mentioned in policy, they have shifted, but employee performance is still definitely a factor when they're in the unfortunate circumstance of having to lay off individuals. So if there's a concern about the teacher evaluation model, presumably you'll get a chance to consider that later this session in another bill. But the bottom line is all employers use the evaluation results when they're stuck having to lay people off. So this is all we're trying to do is give school districts the same option as any other employer in terms of trying to retain talent. And I just would mention that this is something broadly supported by Minnesotans. 91% in a poll by MinCAN said that teacher quality ought to be a factor in determining teacher evaluations and layoffs. And finally, we support sections 11 and 15. Those sections state that a student can't for two consecutive years be assigned the lowest performing teacher. It's especially important for younger students. So thank you very much. Hope you can pass House File 2.
And thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. I appreciate that. And Mr. Solvine, I owe you an apology, and I made an assumption I shouldn't have, and if it helps, many people mistake me for someone who has hair, so I think we're good.
Me too. It isn't the first time.
So I apologize.
I'm not offended. Good afternoon. My name is Stacy Solvine, and I'm the Executive Director of Human Resources for Burnsville-Eagan Savage Schools. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about House File Number 2. I appreciate the discussion that Representative Loon has initiated over retaining effective teachers during ULAs. As I am sure you know, the research demonstrates that the greatest impact on student growth is a highly effective teacher in the classroom. Unfortunately, under current practices of seniority, that is not always the case during staff reductions. In Burnsville, our contract defaults to the statute language and releases the least senior teachers in their license areas. Currently, nearly 24% of our 750 teachers are probationary. In 2005, our district had nearly 11,000 students. Now we are at 9,300. During the past decade, we have had to reduce staff on a number of occasions. During the ULA process, it is not uncommon to receive pushback from parents, students, and the community when an effective teacher has to be released, stating that the decision was made on seniority alone and not on teacher effectiveness leaves many puzzled and unsatisfied. We have good staff. Our teachers work hard and want the best for our students. We have addressed ineffective teaching and seen improvement or personal choices to pursue other opportunities. What we haven't been able to do is to protect those who are the most effective when restructuring is needed. I'm in support of the spirit of the language and have two requests for this bill. That it provides a means to preserve our most effective teaching staff regardless of which they were hired. And two, that it provides data protection for teachers that are placed on unrequested leaves of absence. To the first point, I appreciate having multiple criteria, not just seniority, be agreed to locally. That local control is very important to us. In line 24.1, it appears to say that districts may have probationary teachers be a part of the local agreed upon criteria. I believe that the criteria must include probationary teachers. The locally defined criteria needs to recognize that probationary teachers are often experienced and extremely effective. Not every probationary teacher is straight out of college. Sometimes they come to us with a number of years of experience from another district or state. I would also ask that the other lines that have shadows of the seniority language and recall also be aligned to consider probationary teachers in that same general section. To the second point, I ask that language be included that protects the teacher's ULA status from data requests. There is a difference between a teacher who is released because of performance and someone who is released because we're laying off staff because of reduction of students. Teachers that are on ULA may not be as effective as teachers that are retained, but it should not be interpreted that the two teachers are the same. Often the concerns are limited to specific areas that may improve with efforts from the teacher. If possible, we want to work with the teacher on the targeted areas and hopefully bring them back if we have positions available.
And Mr. Sovine, just so I let you know.
We do not want unwarranted claims that they were released for discipline. When we have to reduce staff again, I hope that the community will look and see that while the teacher numbers are fewer, it is clear to everyone that the most effective team of teachers is still in place. Thank you.
And thank you. And again, my apologies. It won't happen again. former Representative Dietrich, welcome. And Minkam. And then that's what I have on the list. So thank you. It looks like we're going to make my second goal, which was 206.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent over 2,000 school board members across the state, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on House File 2 today. Each of the issues addressed in this bill are very important to school board members, as demonstrated by the 32 references to school board members right in the bill. I'm going to make some general comments about the two major issues in the bill, ULA and then teacher licensure. And for those of you who are in policy committee, my comments will be very similar. So if you need to check your phones or answer your emails, now would be the time to do it, and I won't be offended at all. I would like to outline, as I go along, I'd like to outline some of the challenges also as we still see in the bill, but we would like to acknowledge Representative Loon for already responding to some of the suggestions made in the previous hearing. So I'll go ahead and start with the ULA part of the bill. We want to be very clear, as many other speakers did, that this bill, that the ULA part of this bill is not about getting rid of bad teachers who are not performing. That is the teacher development and evaluation tool that is in statute that does that. The House File 2 ULA language is the tool to retain the best teachers when teacher layoffs are required due to reduction in pupils, reduction in budgets, or consolidation. Obviously, our first preference would be is that the ULA process would never be needed. One way to minimize the impact of that is to adequately fund education. Unfortunately, that is not always our reality, and nor will it ever always be. So with that, we know that school board members are responsible for the hiring and the painful job of letting teachers go when layoffs are required in our schools. When this happens, the school boards need the ability to retain the excellent teachers that best fit the needs of the district, the school, and the students for today and in the future. As I prepared for this testimony, I recall just how painful this process can be. And I think that that's an interesting perspective to bring here to this discussion today. As a school board member in the Anoka-Hennepin School District, we experienced severe budget cuts and, as a result, severe reductions in staffing. When it came time to make the motion to lay those teachers off, it really became a list of teachers' names on a white piece of paper. They were all based on seniority. There was a long silence. Nobody wanted to make the motion, because we knew that those names represented. They were the names of our newest hires, young, energetic, loved by their students and their community. And as a district, we had just put a lot of time and money into their professional development, only to let them go to another school district to benefit them. The most unfortunate part of that experience is that the list did not respond to the staffing needs of the district or their performance, and there was no assurance that we were still retaining the right teacher in the right place for the students. Locally elected school board members are ultimately the ones who are charged with making those staffing decisions, and they are held responsible for the outcomes. Board members should not be limited to one criteria when making these crucial hiring and firing decisions.
And I'm sorry, Ms. District, just to remind you.
Okay, thank you. The public does not understand this type of decision making, and it is very difficult to try to justify that when you see the people who put you in office in the grocery store. I know that we all have our favorite stories of the talented, effective teacher who was let go only because they were the most recently hired. So with that, I think I'm going to stop here and just let you know that the reason for our support is we have a longstanding policy position on this topic, and we do appreciate the chair's, the representative's willingness to make some of the adjustments. We still have two or three more concerns about the bill that many others have already brought up with data privacy and the having a default model, and we hope that the chair will continue to work with us on that. And then in general, on a lot of the teacher licensure areas, we think that there were some very wise choices made in that as well, in making the bill better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you very much for your testimony. And Minkan, and I'm sorry, I don't have a name, so you'll have to state your name. And
Not Mr. Minkan, but
if you'd like to be, that's okay.
Yeah, I'll go by Daniel Sellers, executive director with Minkan. I am a former middle school math teacher who was originally licensed in another state and would have had a very challenging time bringing my license back to Minnesota, though I'm not going to go too much in depth on that. I've been working for the last 4 years in partnership and in attempts to be partners with the Board of Teaching around finding smoother, transparent processes for teachers initially licensed out of state. As many of you know, I'm former executive director with Teach for America in the Twin Cities. My work in this space actually started primarily with alumni of Teach for America, some of whom had taught for 7-10 years and were finding it very difficult to transfer the license to Minnesota. But as Minkan became recognized as an organization that was willing to help people traverse a very confusing and murky process, many, many teachers who were traditionally certified, met incredibly high standards through their programs, were also finding it difficult to transfer their license to Minnesota. 4 years ago, this body passed legislation, and almost nothing has happened. The process is barely any clearer today than it was 4 years ago, and this bill does serve to clarify the process for how the board should recognize not just what somebody brings on their transcript, but in a way that actually elevates the teaching profession, recognizes all the things that a teacher may bring, whether they have good evaluations, whether they have strong record of student achievement, whether they've won awards, whether they can demonstrate their expertise in content or pedagogy, outside of things that may show up on one's transcript. This bill provides the board with the flexibility to look at all the things that somebody brings with them because they want to enter the teaching profession here in Minnesota, and directs them to make that process much easier to understand. Share this testimony before the policy committee. We were contacted by a person who could not figure out how to navigate this process and ended up reaching out to a news reporter for help on getting licensed here in Minnesota. To me, that is not a transparent process, that is not clear, and it's not easy to understand. Very briefly, I'll just say, you know, we've heard questions about, you know, how many people are impacted. The fact of the matter is it's impossible to know, because what happens, just to give you a brief insight into this, is many people reach out, as Aaron Doan from the Board of Teaching said, reach out either to the Board of Teaching or the Department of Education, Department of Licensing, and the first thing they're told to do is not actually submit an application, but they're told to go speak with the College of Teacher Education. They're given no insight into how strong of an application they may have, what their deficiencies are, and of course we know Colleges of Teacher Education have a vested interest in telling you that you have to take all kinds of courses from them at cost in order to get licensed. And so we're asking the Board of Teaching to take responsibility for explaining exactly what your deficiencies might be and how you might remedy those. Furthermore, as I testified before, we've started recommending to candidates that they actually partner with lawyers in order to get licensed to teach in Minnesota. And to me, that's crazy. And we've now sent more than a dozen candidates to partner with a lawyer. And why is this? It's because they're still struggling to traverse.
And Mr. Sellers, I think it was the word lawyers that, no, I'm just kidding. You're at times. Yep. You're getting close.
Because as they asked for final determination on their applications, they weren't being told of what deficiencies they still had. They weren't being told of their right to appeal. These are sort of basic administrative expectations. So, you know, how big of a deal is this? I would say at least hundreds of teachers who, and many, many school districts who are extremely frustrated by the current process and who are looking to you for remedies on how to make the process more transparent and straightforward. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your testimony. And with that, that's the list that I had. I would like to take public testimony at this time. I'd like it to be brief if we could, because we do have a couple people that I believe have some time constraints for tonight. So with that, is there anybody that's interested in public testimony? And Mr. Heller, if you could come down, and I'd ask that I could keep your comments to 2 minutes, because I would like to get some questions in for a couple of these folks before we recess. And Mr. Heller, if you could state your name for the record.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rick Heller. I officially represent the Tri-Six Help Show and Print Disabled. I'm here commenting on House File 2. First of all, since this is about finances, can we really afford, as we move ahead with these assessments, because first of all, is the ACT assessment, when it was designed, using principles of universal design? These are questions perhaps the audience could answer. However, it would have to come from people that are listening. I am not here by myself, and it's for the leaders to ask those questions, not me. Another, perhaps, a question would be, it's my understanding there's three types of assessments that may be for teachers. Yeah, they implemented principle of universal design for those being summative. Are they adaptive? Do they adjust when teachers want feedback? Just like the MCA3s for the children use adaptive testing, which is summative. It provides input back for the teachers to know how to approach an assessment. Now, that every teacher can propose, teacher or wannabe teacher can access an assessment like the norm. Perhaps these are the twice exceptional teachers, which is found in statute, in the gifted statute, which hasn't been identified yet.
And Mr. Heller, if you could move to wrap it up, please.
It's my understanding, maybe perhaps somebody can answer this question, since we've added two strands of reading, phonemic and phonemic awareness, what assessment, be it adaptive or not, that checks that skill and knowledge, as well as relates to universal design principles, if it's adaptive or not. Perhaps these questions are relevant, too, to the principal when they evaluate teachers and their peers. Are there elements in their local plan to implement the three elements of universal design?
And
not just for assessment.
I ask you to wrap it up, please. We are at the 2 minutes.
Well, thank you. And then not only in assessment, but in the classroom. Since universal design for assessments is essential, and also essential in the classroom for learning, how does this fit into this element of going ahead on these assessments? And hopefully, in the next 2 weeks at the Senate, there will be a discussion with the National Center of Education Outcome with the U of M on principal universal design for assessments, the Minnesota Department of Education, and perhaps people at St. Thomas that talk about the twice exceptions. We can help bring some light on this important thing. I appreciate anybody that will ask questions to the individuals that are here, including the Board of Teaching, about the twice exceptional on that area. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for the testimony. And thank you to all the testifiers. And so at that point, I'd like to move to members' question. I would like to put a priority on Ms. Cragthorpe and Mr. Olson. If we could direct questions to them first, if members have any questions to them. Seeing none. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't clear on, was Mr. Olson testifying as a teacher or as a graduate student? Or I didn't get exactly. I got that he was a parent, and I got that he was a teacher.
And Mr. Olson, if you could come down.
Something about River Falls, but I wasn't sure what he was.
Sure. And Mr. Olson, to Representative Murphy's questions.
Representative Murphy, when I submitted my request to testimony to testify, I officially submitted it as a member of the Minnesota Network of State Teachers of the Year. But I am happy also to, in addition to testifying in that capacity as the 2008 Minnesota Teacher of the Year, to testify as a parent, a teacher, a graduate student, and an author of research on teacher quality and evaluation. You can take your pick. But I officially said Minnesota Network of State Teachers of the Year.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I think that's probably the best.
Mr. Representative Murphy.
And actually, I think the best is as a parent.
And thank you,
you
Mr. Olson. And Representative Mariani, you have a question?
Well, quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Olson, I have to say, anyone who can get on the phone with Charlotte Danielson, that's pretty darn impressive. I'm wondering if maybe you can just very quickly, because there are a lot of new members here, tell us who she is. My understanding is she's really one of the gurus when it comes to our modern teacher development and evaluation frameworks. We've been referencing her here under both GOP and DFL control of this body for over a decade. So I'm just wondering if you can just tell quickly, who is she and why is it significant that she responded the way that she responded to your query?
Well, and Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Representative Chairman. She is definitely considered one of the leaders and gurus in teacher evaluation, indeed in the world. Her framework for teaching was developed, I believe, originally in the 90s, and has since evolved through many different stages. And again, she's consulted with by nations looking at, you know, how to do this in their country. You know, in their country, she goes all around the country, and her tool framework for teaching is the most common used base for evaluations of teacher observations by principals and trained administrators. And so I was thrilled to end up, that is the topic of my dissertation. What I'm doing is having award-winning teachers look at all the components in those and which of those are the ones that really matter. But I think, so back to the second part of your question, what were her concerns? She, of course, believes in teacher evaluation. And by the way, as a teacher, so do I. I think it's so important that, and I think most teachers do, and there's sometimes a perception that we don't, that we're fearful of evaluation. I welcome evaluation. It's a great way to grow and get better and develop. And that is the primary motives and designs behind these tools. Her concern was that, I have more quotes from her, which I wish I had had time to get into, that I thought about putting my test through. One of the things I thought was very interesting that she said is, validity of the judgment depends on the accuracy of the judge. Training is no guarantee of accuracy. And she said, I can guarantee you that, you know, that in Minnesota right now, your average administrator is in no position to be making reliable judgments that would be sufficient in there. And this isn't to slam a principal or an administrator, but that the amount of training and the amount of multiple administrators that need to come in and observe somebody before you can put any sort of significant accuracy on that evaluation to make these high-stakes decisions is significant. And there's plenty of research studies that show that the measures of effective teaching is probably the most largest and most well-known. But there's many, many others that indicate that same thing.
And if I could, Mr. Olson, if that information is available, I'm sure there's many members of the committee that would love to see it. That sounds very intriguing. Representative Marion, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Chairman, the challenge with that particular information is that that's me trying to scribble while she's talking to me from on her cell phone in her British accent. So it's not those quotes, which it's actually, that's why I didn't put that in my testimony, because it was indeed casual and not anything I could verify in a published way.
And Representative Erickson. I'm sorry, Representative Mariani, did you have a follow-up? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Krisha. And to that point, Mr. Olson, did Ms. Danielson get a chance to read that section of the bill, or did you read it to her or forward it to her so she knows that teacher evaluation is just one piece of that list that could be negotiated between boards and bargaining units?
Thank you for your question, Senator Erickson.
Mr. Olson?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative,
and if I could just,
I haven't been elevated to the Senate.
Mr. Olson, I just ask you to direct your comments to the chair. Mr. Olson, go ahead.
I apologize.
It's for little indulgences we get, not much.
Well, and I should know this because when I head off to teach at River Falls, which was why I need to go, it's for a social studies methods course, and one of those strands is civics, so I should know these procedures. I apologize. I did not, because that is something that I felt you as a committee will be making the decision. I wanted to find out specifically her opinion on the usage of her tool for that purpose. There's quite a few. I'm aware that there's many pieces, also other pieces, even within a summative evaluation besides the observation by a trained administrator. But I specifically wanted to be able to share with you all, since I had a unique opportunity to talk to her, her opinion on the usage of that tool for that purpose. So that would have to be a separate question to say, okay, now what about that tool being part of a larger being a piece of the pie? I did not ask it as a piece of the pie question.
Representative Erickson, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Olson, listening to Eden Prairie, note that they're using proficiency or not proficient. How does that fit into the Danielson model? Because I know the framework is, I know the framework, and that doesn't seem to fit, and I don't know if Eden Prairie is using Danielson anyway, but how does that appeal to you, having just proficient and non-proficient as the two categories?
Mr. Olson.
Mr.
I can't
Chair,
answer it for you. You have that part.
Trying to remember who I'm supposed to address. Quite honestly, I would have to look at Eden Prairie's TDE plan. I didn't mention this. I was also on the committee that developed, one of the teacher representatives on our committee that developed our plan in Stillwater, and we put, you know, we started right away, and we put hours and hours and hours of time and hard work, and are very happy to have a plan that administrators and teachers both believe in, and I think, well, I'll stick to the question. And so I think that it would seem to me that proficient and unproficient certainly has some benefits to something like is being re-added in now, as my understanding of the ranking terminology, which Senator Loon mentioned today, which is where I really get concerned when I think about where you're literally ranking teachers. That, in my opinion, is the least appealing approach. And I honestly would have to see specifically what they're doing. I do know that although many people on our committee, teachers and administrators, would be happy with what we have as a plan, those same people, when asked, would be unhappy if they were told it was now being used for making high-stakes decisions like unrequested leave.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And any further questions for Mr. Olson while we have him on the stand? Then I'll ask any further. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any further questions for Ms. Cragthorpe? If not, I hope you have a wonderful birthday. Thank you. And with that, members, we have 4 minutes. We can either take a question or two now or... Well, let's do that. I guess we have four. Do we have any questions before 2:30? Representative Erickson, and then Representative
Ford. Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Is Ms. Ford still here from MACT?
Ms. Ford, could you come down, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ford, I've looked at licensure in at least surrounding states, And could you comment on to what extent you know about neighboring states or even other states, because we're going to have to look far to find the diverse teacher population that I'd like to see in our state, to what extent they use the in-task standards or have modified them like Minnesota has?
Nearly all states use the in-task standards.
So that's correct. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Ford. So if all of the states are using these, and they were pretty much dictated to do so a few years ago, and they're always in revision, because when I served on the board, we had the first set of in-task, and then we immediately went into a revision because that's what occurs, just like our regular standards. But if that is so, then shouldn't that be one of the bases for crossing a state line to apply for licensure in a state if those standards have been adhered to?
The second question that you posed is if those standards had been adhered to and at what level is really the item of question. Every state may use the basis of the in-task standards, but then redefine those standards at different levels of rigor. And that is what you would find in most states. How those standards are then measured in every state depends on the rigor with which either the legislature or the Board of Teaching or whoever is setting those standards has set those standards. In Minnesota, we have already set those standards at a very rigorous level. Both the state legislature and the Board of Teaching, whether it's legislated in tests and what kind of tests we must have and even the passing scores in the legislation that's before you, or whether it's in the standards that are developed at the state that are approved through our rulemaking process, are very rigorous. They require a different level of measurement in order to qualify to be recognized in Minnesota as an effective teacher.
Mr.
And,
Chair?
Yep, and before your question, if I could just ask a quick question, Representative Murphy. I know we could take an amendment and take it a vote. Would you be amenable to that, or would you like to see us go ahead and go into recess? I'm just asking the committee what your intentions would be, just for clarification.
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. Mr. Chair, when we started out, you said that you wanted testimony on, since this was a finance committee, mm-hmm. you wanted testimony on to address the finances. I found this very interesting, this entire conversation. Very, very interesting. But I haven't heard one thing about finances of any component of this House File 2 or seen anything about costs of House File 2. And so if we're going to go forward, are we going to talk about finances? If we're going to meet after, or are we going to talk about finances or the costs of to the Board of Teaching or the licensure or to the colleges that prepare education, or are we going to talk any more about finances than we already have?
And thank you, Representative Murphy. It's my understanding we have had no testifiers on that. And if members would like questions to that effect, that's why we have Representative Luna as the bill author, and I'm sure we would entertain those. So that's the information that I have on that.
Okay.
Representative Murphy?
Then, Mr. Chair, I don't think we are prepared to send this to the floor, because the other overwhelming thing that was pointed out in three different times was data privacy. And so if this bill was to move, I don't think the motion was correct to send it to the General Register. I think the correct motion would be to send it to the Civil Law Committee, and so they could discuss that data privacy thing.
And thank you, Representative Murphy. As I understand, the author's intent is to send this to the General Register, if at which time it would ask to be re-referred on the House floor, we could do so. I'll go back and just ask my question again. If you'd like to, we can. We could wrap this up.
The other thing yep. that I will mention is, I think we have not concluded the discussion of yep. House File 2 as this committee should, or as at least yep. as we started out to, and so we would continue. But I would like to tell you something.
Yes, thank you, Representative Murphy.
On Tuesdays at 4:35 to 5:05, the DFL members of this committee have a standing meeting every Tuesday. And so we would appreciate it very much if you don't start at 5, because we do have an agenda for that meeting today. And now if we go into recess, we'll probably talk a little bit faster to get both agendas done. So I'd appreciate it if you didn't have reconvening at 5.
Representative Murphy, I appreciate that. Would 5:15 be amenable to your side?
That would be much better.
Okay. And so, members, we will recess at 5:15. Representative Erickson, did you want to quickly finish your line of questioning?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair.
If not, thank you, members. We'll see you at 5:15 at this room. Thank you. Okay, members, we are back from recess of the Education Finance Committee. Welcome again, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And at this point where we left off, we had a question from Representative Bennett. Is she here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will pass on that. It got answered
okay.
earlier.
So. Thank you, Representative Bennett. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy, did you have any further questions, or did you want to move to other members?
Mr. Chair, I still have some financial questions about if there are costs to any of the agencies that are mentioned in here, or any of the school districts. And I have a question on, I'm still wondering why we don't have a fiscal note. And I asked Ms. Johnson why there isn't a fiscal note, and she said that none had been requested. And are we at the point where we think that this bill can be implemented as the state law, and that there won't be any additional costs? And no one has directly talked to that, or are we to assume that the departments and the school districts and the Board of Teaching and the Department of Education just can pay for it through their normal way of ensuring licensures or giving out licensures and waivers and all the things that have been mentioned this afternoon?
And Representative Murphy, in the conversations between the committees, at this point, nobody has offered any testimony that there would be costs. They've had ample time. Coming to the Finance Committee, I think, was a courtesy. But at this point, nobody has testified that there would be. And Representative Loon, do you want to shed some light to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, you and I had a conversation after the committee had recessed, and I wanted to, just for the benefit of the committee, bring that up and then share with you something that I didn't say when we discussed that I was thinking about something else. But just to make clear, there is one provision that in reviewing House File 2 as I originally introduced it, I thought could potentially have a small fiscal impact, and so I did address that in my author's amendment that we adopted today, and that was the licensure under by portfolio issue, which my original bill had moved that from the Department of Education Licensing Division to the Board of Teaching, and it wasn't my intent to have all that review of the portfolios and that done by Board of Teaching staff. So I made it clear in the author's amendment I wasn't doing that, but more, as the amendment stated, that the Board of Teaching should communicate with the teacher candidate if they were rejected, here's reasons why and here's some suggestions or rationale for why you were rejected. But it wasn't to have the review of that portfolio moved, and that would have triggered a fiscal impact, I believe. So that was addressed to the author's amendment, and again, to my knowledge, there would be no other fiscal impacts and no one else, the department and the board did not come forward to implicate that there would be fiscal impacts from the bill.
And
Representative, further questions, Representative?
Mr. Chair, is the Board of Teaching, is there a representative Board of Teaching here?
Is the Board of Teaching representative in the audience? I do not see them, Representative Murphy. I'm sorry, I can't call them down.
So we can't ask them then. Could I ask a question to Ms. Glover?
I'm sorry.
Could I ask a question to Ms. Glover?
You may ask a question, Representative Murphy, and if you're here, you can come down. And I would like to remind the members, at the onset, we did ask people to bring up fiscal issues, and we haven't heard any. So I understand where you're going, and I'll allow the latitude. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi, Ms. Glover.
Yes.
During the testimony this afternoon, you talked about litigation, more opportunities for people to enter into litigation, and several other people talked about litigation. If litigation is taken up, who would, under this House File 2, who would have to pay the costs of the litigations? And I know that there were several different litigations that were indicated that could happen, but who would do that?
Ms. Glover?
Mr. Chair, I think that I did identify costly legal challenges a couple of times in my testimony today, did mention that and highlighted that as one of the sincere concerns about this. Speaking of who would incur the costs of litigation, school districts will incur costs related to litigation around layoffs if these layoff provisions take effect. I don't know what those costs would look like, but we could, and of course those costs will vary whether someone has an in-house counsel or whether they have to hire an outside attorney. But because there is a process in House File 2 in the language that says you can challenge your layoff through that process, and it says you can challenge whether or not the process was followed. That would cause some costs. It doesn't get at the quality question, which I would imagine individual teachers may seek to challenge. And there's a couple of avenues they could do that. One avenue would be through the Government Data Practices Act. There was a case that happened recently that we found out that evaluation data could be challenged through a Government Data Practice Act contested case in order to correct any inaccuracies in the data. So if you have an evaluation, for example, that has an underlying premise that can be proven to be false. Say, for example, you...
And Ms. Glover, I'm just wondering, I think the original question was who would pay?
Who would pay? School districts. School districts will incur costs related to this. What those costs look like and how much they are will be different based on whether or not they have in-house counsel or whether or not they need to hire someone out. It'll be whether or not it's just a ULA challenge a challenge to the layoff itself, whether or not they'll actually have to challenge their evaluations, whether there's a mechanism within the TDE plan itself to challenge through the grievance process or not. Those TDE plans are all different. There are lots of ways in which challenges could take place, and how those would play out and the costs associated with it, I don't know for certain, but school districts will incur a cost for legal challenges related to the layoff provisions.
Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. If you could stay at the table,
yes,
please. You talked about one possible avenue for a teacher contesting a layoff would be a data practices request. Now, I don't know your areas of legal expertise, and I don't know if they cover data practices. Are there charges associated with data practices? Would there be a cost to the state, not school districts, but to the state, in complying with a data practice request from a teacher who was grieving or litigating their ULA?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. I mean, the mechanism for a contested case hearing is through the Office of Administrative Hearings.
And if I could, Ms. Glover, I'm just so I have clarification, Representative Dabney, are you answering on the cost for an agency, or are you just falling through the line of assumptions? Just so I understand.
Thank you. Good clarification, Mr. Chair. I can't assume what those costs would be, but the process for a challenge through the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act is through a contested case to the Office of Hearings, Office of Administrative Hearings. So there would have to be costs associated with that, presumably.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney, excuse me.
Thank you, sir. I'm trying to remember. It's just been too long since I've sat at the table and was knowledgeable about some of these things, but who bears the cost of a contested case hearing before the Office of Administrative Hearings? Is that jointly shared by the district and the individual? Is it absorbed by the Office of Administrative Hearings? I just don't remember. Can you help me, please?
And Ms. Glover?
Ms.
And before you answer, could you also answer, just for my clarification, if those practices already exist? So do you believe we're adding practices with additional costs, if that helps?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the cost that there are, let me explain. Minnesota Government Data Practices Act says an individual can challenge their data. And so that individual teacher would be challenging their evaluation data. And they would be going to this neutral and saying, you know, the school district got it wrong. So the school district, to participate in that and defend on that, would presumably have their litigation, might incur costs associated with that litigation. The individual teacher might. But certainly there are costs to doing a hearing like that, evidence. The Schwanke case that we was a decision that happened recently, there were, I think, 300 or 400 additional pages of evidence that were brought into the contested case that were not part of the original discussion about the evaluation. So these cases are rigorous and have produce evidence, decisions, provide testimony. There are costs associated with that. Does that answer your question, Representative? I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm being responsive.
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vogel, yes, because I'm picturing the administrative law judge.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have some sort of staff. I don't know if there's, what do you call the folks who type up all the
right, court reporters,
thank
and transcribers?
Thank mm-hmm. you, thank you, sorry. Are these procedures documented?
Absolutely.
As a court case is?
Mm-hmm.
Is that your question?
And then there's lawyers. There's always lawyers. So, I mean, we seem to be establishing that there will be a cost to the state, at a minimum through the Office of Administrative Hearings, for this, associated with this bill, and expanded use of the OAH for, I'm going to say grieving, but that's probably not the right word, contesting.
How'd I do? Okay, good. Picking up lawyer language. For contesting layoffs under this process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Danner, just so I'm clear, did you have another question there, or was that just your final comments on that line?
Final comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I'm hearing correctly, the testifier mentioned that there's already, referring to an existing case, so apparently there's already this type of activity coming on, and we're debating the speculation that there may be more. Does staff recall, I don't believe we funded anything in the bill that allowed for PEEP to be promulgated, and that therefore there were also some cases where I believe in not giving a quote and et cetera, where there could be exposure to litigation. Have been on a school board before, I know there's always exposure to litigation, whether you do something right or wrong, you have exposure. And so I'm just trying to understand what the difference is, since one, all of these things appear to already be happening since they're being used to show example of cost, and two, we didn't allocate dollars for people to do their normal tasks and activities when we did the PEEP thing. So there was the exposure of exposed cost, and we never funded that. So I guess I'm lost, and if there's some clarification staff can give about the precedence of, this guessing who might sue us at what time.
Thank you, Representative Quam. If I can direct to Ms. Johnson and Mr. Strom, in your wonderful world of spreadsheets, can you draw up an assumption of litigation costs and what that may be, and is that customary to do so in this committee? How's that for trying to paraphrase?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think the distinction that's being made between when there's a cost borne by a state agency is a different issue than when there's an appropriation required by a program, which is a different issue from whether school districts or the parties involved in school district disputes face a cost. So you sort of have three levels of analysis here. You have the issue about the teachers in the school districts potentially bearing costs. Those sometimes are captured in something called a local impact note. And then you may have agency costs that agencies can deal with or may not have agency costs that agencies can deal with. And you may have appropriations costs for bills, for example, that increase the formula allowance or something like that. So the issue with a fiscal note is the fiscal note could identify either of those two sets of costs. It would not identify local costs that the district or the teachers may face with an issue. And when it gets to a fiscal note, then the question becomes whether a fiscal note on an agency shows an increase or not, and that's sometimes the history of this committee and this body is that certain costs are told that that's within the purview of what the agency's already doing and sometimes not. So I guess that's a way of saying it depends. But for either whether there's state costs or program costs at the state level, that's generally where the fiscal note might identify those. But whether those are costs that are required to be funded, as Representative Quam raised or not, would depend in part on the legislature's view on whether the agency already has sufficient resources to assist with those tasks.
And Mr. Strom, as a former CFO, you had me at appropriations, but Representative Quam, do you have follow-up to that?
Mr. Chair, no, I think staff sufficiently clarified where we stand, and I'm happy with this response.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on the characterization of how the discussion is going. It seems to be as though there's a presumption that every discharge would be appealed. Most people in the course of their work will undergo reviews, and usually in that review process you'll sign that you've had that review, that you agree with the things that have happened. If somebody, to characterize feeling an unjust departure, that data that's maintained by the school is private data. The appellant has the ability to request under MGDPA to see that file. It can be shared voluntarily by the school district, or if they take the position they don't want to share it, then through MGDPA you can get it. But even in that event, it doesn't necessarily change the data, and the notion that it always is going to end up in a long, contentious litigation process is presumptive, I think, at the best. Doesn't mean that it won't happen, but it doesn't mean that it will. And I think there are people who are aggrieved right now that find themselves in a departure situation that are already going through this process. So I think it's kind of hard to quantify, you know, that it's going to be extraordinary cost.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that we're wrestling with a decision that typically would be answered by the parts of the system that are entrusted with carrying out new policies. And the way we do that, quite frankly, members, is that we ask for fiscal notes from those departments. I don't know that a fiscal note has been drafted. I don't see one here. Chair Loon, have you requested a fiscal note of any of the governmental entities that are going to be required to do new things here, particularly the Board of Teaching, presumably the Department of Education?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, no, I have not. And we did have some consultation through my committee administrator with nonpartisan staff. When you referenced new activities and that by the Board of Teaching, I'm asking the Board of Teaching to promulgate rules, and that is something that's already within their area of responsibility. So setting a deadline for that did not, in our opinion, trigger something that would require a fiscal note.
Representative Mariani, follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Chair Loon. I get that the board has the standing rulemaking authority. However, typically it costs money to actually do a rule. There are hearings that have to be held, information needs to be gathered. Would it be our position then that all that work that would need to be done, the Board of Teaching needs to do within its existing appropriations level?
Representative Loon.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, as you know, at some point here soon, the session of this committee will work on putting together a finance package that will encompass the Board of Teaching and lots of other things that we fund. But again, in terms of directing a rulemaking and a specific time frame for that is something that does not, as a regular course of action, require a specific appropriation for it or a cost. We ask agencies on a regular basis to take regulatory action without providing a specific funding for it. So, no, I don't believe it would require specific funding.
And just as a—and thank you, Representative—and just as a follow-up, and I think we're all aware of how things move down here, nobody has testified to cost today. There were no flags that came up, even though, again, we've asked and we've posted. So I think that's a clear distinction that the Board of Teaching, MDE, other agencies have not come up and raised a flag. Representative Newton, I'll come back to you. I'm sorry. Representative Mariani, follow-up, then Representative Newton.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think that's, frankly, a safe assumption for us to operate under. I think we should exercise our own wisdom based on our knowledge of what it takes to carry out good policy. And if it's our position that the Board of Teaching or any other entity simply needs to swallow that cost, then we should simply say that. I would hope that, we've heard some testimony, more in the policy committee, maybe perhaps a little bit here this morning, about this particular entity. It's a very small entity. It's a very small entity that over the course of the last few years has been asked to do some pretty important work, work that really ensures the quality of our policies, particularly of our teaching corps. So it's all good work, and there's been good bipartisan support on that. But for us to pretend that I would argue, for that entity to be able to do, yet another piece of work there and just absorb that cost, I think we're undermining our own policy. I think you may be undermining your own policy efforts here, Chairman Loon. I get that you want to move the bill forward. I think what I heard from Chairman Loon just now is that I think, you know, that at the point at which we're doing a finance bill, we should circle back to this conversation relative to the Board of Teaching. I think that would be a good conversation. I just simply wish we were having it at the same time.
And Representative Mariani, thank you for that. I will tell you on a personal level, I appreciate the perspective. Thank you for circling back on that. Duly noted. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Loon, I'm a little confused, actually, because this is a finance committee, and you're saying, and it sounds as if we really don't have any fiscal note associated with this bill. It's already passed the policy committee. I'm not on the policy committee. So is this just informational for us? Are you going to be asking us to vote on something? Is it, you know, in terms of being a finance committee, there's basically not much for us to vote on if you don't have financial implications in the bill.
Thank Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, yes, it is our intention to ask the committee to render a vote on the bill. And as I discussed earlier, we'll need the initial provisions in my bill before I change this with the author's amendment would have moved a new function to the Board of Teaching, the licensure by portfolio, a function that they did not previously have. And so I made it clear that I was retaining that function within the Department of Education's licensing division. And so, again, I know that that would have been a fiscal a duty with a fiscal impact, a new duty on the Board of Teaching. So that was addressed in my author's amendment. So that was the fiscal impact potential that I was aware of, and again, no others have come forward to testify with concerns about fiscal impact, with the exception of representative from Education Minnesota.
And just Ms. Glover, if you'd like, unless somebody else has a question, but you're welcome to come back if we need you.
Thank you.
Representative Van Zyls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frankly, Madam Chair, I've never seen this done before in this committee, that a bill which is described as not having any fiscal implications comes here as its last stop before going to the floor. I don't know that I've ever seen that before, and I'm not casting aspersions or anything else. You're an honorable person, and I know you care about kids in schools, and I happen to like you.
Can I enter that in the record?
I like you too, Representative Angel.
But that's my first question. My second question or thought really has to do with down the road a bit. There is going to be a cost to this, members, but it's going to be at your local school district level. That's where costs are going to be borne. Thirdly, Madam Chair, I get the sense that the good people who helped you with this bill really haven't been in a classroom for a long time. They really and truly have no idea what goes on in a school where layoffs are imminent in the spring, and how hurtful and impactful that can be to the entire community. And with the system that we would be moving toward under House File 2, I see a contentious back and forth, teacher on teacher, teacher on administrator, teacher on school board member, animosity, which is going to be a really big deal for every lawyer on Main Street who has a shingle up. So I don't have a question, and again, I like you, but I would hope I would hope we'd think a little bit about this before we take what I think is a drastic step of moving this to the General Register. I just don't think that this is ready enough. So that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you, Representative.
Hope you're not offended.
Representative.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansels. And no, I'm not offended. And I would imagine in almost any scenario, a member will encounter a situation where not everyone will like or vote for their bill. And that's I'm a realist about that. But I would also just like to say with regards to this is that, you know, let's step back and take a little bit of perspective as well on what I am seeking and how I am seeking it. You know, there's been a fair amount of discussion about the teacher evaluations and high-stake tests and that. To be clear, my bill does say that these evaluations should be part of the process. I do not prescribe how much of the process. I leave the door wide open for other factors as are locally negotiated. We have pushed out the effective date another year, so we're talking starting from right now about 4 years for districts, meaning their leadership, their administrators, their school boards and that, and their teachers' union representatives to work this out before it would become effective. So, you know, I guess I'm an optimist as well, but I feel like that is providing a great amount of latitude for districts to work on this, that it is, again, a locally negotiated process. And if you have a process that is negotiated, that means that the unions have a say in this, they have a stake in this clearly. And I just think that, you know, some of the concerns that address are maybe a bit overblown. You know, and with regards to the disruption in a community when a school has to make these tough decisions, that happens now under the seniority system. It may be leave a little less, I guess, to the question if you have a list of hiring date and that, but it's no less angst on the community or on the teachers that get let go or on the children that are in the families that are impacted when layoffs happen. So, you know, it's maybe angst wrought from a different system, but angst nonetheless.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like Ms. Glover to return to the table.
Ms. Glover, could you please come down?
Thank you, Representative Mr. Chair. Erickson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Glover, I want to build a little bit on what Representative Loon was just noting. These are locally negotiated. So in your comments about, whoa, there's going to be a lot of litigation, et cetera, what do you think is going to happen with the bargaining unit? Are they going to put little seeds within this so they can litigate? Or, you know, what is it you're imagining is going to happen here? Because the teacher evaluation had the same, you know, some of the same rhetoric coming, as I recall. Oh, there are going to be all these, you know, bad things happening. Well, now it's the school board and the bargaining unit, and I can't imagine, as professionals, if I were in that position, and I once was, that I'd be sitting down with my board and negotiating for some part of the teacher effectiveness, for example, that was going to cause my colleagues pain. So describe for us what you imagine will happen in these negotiations so that, you know, we avoid this litigation. Give us the best scenario you can think of.
Ms. Glover, I guess we're asking you to continue to speculate.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we see legal challenges in three areas. One will be challenges to the layoffs themselves. I, Jessanna Glover, am a teacher, and I'm placed on layoff. I'm going to challenge that layoff through whatever mechanism I have. Maybe that's through the hearing. Maybe it's through a writ to the Court of Appeals because the local school board made a decision and I don't agree with it.
Second, you're going to have a challenge to the evaluations as they happen through the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. I don't like my evaluation. And because you have now created the link between my individual evaluation, which was for my improvement, you've created this link to I could lose my job through layoff, I'm going to challenge my evaluation. So yes, I do see there will be an increase in legal challenges to what your evaluation looks like, says, the accuracy, the quality of the evaluator, whether that evaluator was trained properly, whether they have biases. And then the third area you're going to see challenges is through TDE itself, the teacher development and evaluation. Lots of those plans say, here's the internal mechanism you can use to challenge, whether that's through a grievance process or whether or not that's through a different kind of appeals process. Those are all locally decided on. And so those are kind of the three big areas I would see a lot more happening. Certainly people have had a right to use the Data Practices Act to challenge, but it is the seed, as you put it, the seeds to litigation is the combination of evaluation for improvement to evaluation with direct employment consequences that may happen years down the line. The language right now says the most recent evaluation outcomes, but TDE is based on a three-year model. So I might get my summative evaluation in year two of that three-year cycle, but I'm not going to have another evaluation for a couple years down the road. I might improve, and that's not going to necessarily matter under this. And so I am speculating, Mr. Chair, that there will be challenges that will come out in those three kind of primary areas.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think she misunderstood my question. Maybe I was not clear. Of all of these options that a bargaining unit and a school board have, give me the best scenario of how you would organize it so that perhaps if you're so afraid of litigation because of teacher effectiveness, what percentage, for example, could that count? I mean, what's the best scenario for a bargaining unit and a school board to figure out as they negotiate this plan? So there is nothing that's going to happen that's negative.
Ms. Glover.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, there is no one size fits all.
That's right.
And I think that is kind of the bottom line on this. And a mandate through House File 2, mandating the use of these effectiveness categories or now ratings or rankings. I'm sorry, I don't have the amendment in front of me. Either way, that use will lead to a one-size-fits-all kind of idea, but it doesn't work that way for layoff. It absolutely does not work that way. Teacher development and evaluation is 300 plans across the state that are unique. Some of them will have effectiveness categories. Some will not. They will have to go back and look at those again and decide what they want it to look like and then try to figure out how to use layoff and then try to figure out how they're going to implement that. And locals can do it, Representative Erickson, if they want to. I think they absolutely can. The costly part of here is this legislation mandates everybody do this without regard to what they want, what they need, or how they want it to run.
And well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Glover, I disagree.
Quickly, Representative Erickson, just a moment. I would just remind a couple of things. We're sitting very close to each other. I would remind you to come through the chair and through the microphones. Representative Erickson.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention to Ms. Glover that this I don't know, when were you last in the classroom?
I'm not a teacher.
Ms. Glover.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're not in the classroom. I've been there. I know Mr. Detmer has, Mr. Anzales has, and others. Ms. Bennett is still in the classroom, so to speak. But this is not what we do to each other when we sit down to negotiate something. Because we're on one side and the school board's on another, and in every one of my situations, we honored one another. And we thought of the professionalism, and now we're going to add one more category, possibly. I mean, I don't know what percentage it might be very minor to consider teacher effectiveness. And you're building this up to be some huge piece of litigation, and therefore we can't adopt this when 20 states already don't use seniority. So are they involved in litigation? I don't think so. I haven't heard any cases coming out of those states. So, you know, I don't want you to answer me anymore because I think I've, you know, set the stage for you're blowing this out of proportion. This is something that is
as Representative Loon said, going to be negotiated, and it'll consist of all sorts of different combinations. Yes, we'll have 300-plus different plans. That's good, because every district is unique. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Erickson. And I think you do raise one interesting and good point. There's many educators in this committee, and we all have very close ties to the jobs we've done. I know myself has been in the classroom, and we take it very personally. And so many perspectives, and I thank you, Representative. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And continuing on with a little bit of what Representative Erickson was saying, to the author of the bill, what happens if when the school district and the teachers are negotiating, what if they don't come up with a solution? What happens?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt. Well, and I think this gets a little bit to some of the suggestions or questions offered by some of the testifiers today. You know, what is the fallback? You know, there was a, what do you want to call it, a stick or a carrot or whatever in the teacher evaluation. There was the model that was created, and if you didn't have one of your own, that would be the model you would use. I don't propose that, despite a couple of requests. I'm thinking about that, but it's my understanding, and I would call on our nonpartisan staff if I'm incorrect, but it's my understanding that if we say that a process must need to be negotiated, that it must be part of your contract negotiations with your teachers. And in order to have a completed contract or to change from an existing or a continuing contract, this would have to be part of it when we reach the point where this would become effective.
Representative Marquardt, okay. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if there was not an agreement, that means the current contract at the current salary rate would remain in effect for perpetuity, potentially?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, I believe that would be the case if there would be no negotiated agreement reached.
I want to move back to policy, if I could, in this finance committee, but I'd like to. A question on 1711 and 1712. What is this, and I know you probably covered it under policy, what is the effectiveness category? It talks about one of the things would be most recent evaluation outcomes and effectiveness category. That's on 17.12. I looked through the statute, 122A.40, subdivision 8, and it mentions evaluation outcomes but doesn't mention effectiveness category. Is that something new, or did I just miss that in the statute under the teacher evaluation law?
And Representative Loon, I know we're trying to keep to the financial matters, but understanding the question and all level attitude, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt. Again, it's the reference to the model that was created that had a suggestion of effectiveness categories, the default model, exactly. That is, again, anecdotally, I've heard that not many districts are using, and we heard testimony from my own district today that they did not have those, you know, four categories or categories. They basically just decided to place someone as proficient or not proficient. And what I'm referencing, and I did make a slight change to that in the amendment, was to try to encompass many different versions of what districts may be coming up with. It's not to say that districts have to have a requisite number of categories or rating. It's trying to encompass the fact that different evaluation systems are going to have different terminology or methods of what they create in having devised their evaluation systems.
Representative Marquardt. And thank you. And I think in Representative Anzels was, I think, alluding to this. I mean, it's how it actually works in the classroom and how it actually works. And I think the big cost loss in this is going to be to our future economy, when in fact this doesn't improve student achievement but actually decreases it. And the reason I say that is because we have something in place now, the new teacher development and evaluation reform, that I firmly believe is going to increase student achievement. And I think, and I want to allude to this, I think House File 2 is counterproductive and will undermine that. Let me, how many in here have actually gone through the new teacher evaluation reform that was, well, this year is the first year it's in effect. Has anyone around this table actually gone through it? Okay. I also went through it this year. And let me, I mean, I just think it's important that we actually know what it's about, because we talk so much in theory and it gets political, but, and I don't even know if I supported that evaluation bill back in 2011. I think I might have voted against
it. You voted no.
Okay, yes. And, but I'm telling you right now, I might be one of the strongest proponents. And it is something that was talked about. This is true reform. I had a summative evaluation in my classroom for the first time in, I think, the Reagan administration. And let me, but I do want to go through it. I mean, first of all, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but I just think it's so important because we've got something in place. And Mr. Aronson, I think, hit it right on the head. He said we're trying to balance giving local school boards flexibility, but also at the same time protecting seniority. And I think under 122A.40 subdivision 8 clause 13, as I was reading the book, that allows, it says if you're not meeting the standards and you're, you know, the principal has decided you're not, it allows for termination, non-renewal, leave of absence, transfer. It's there. Our locally elected school boards and principals have something in place right now. And here's, I'm not going to give you the ratings on mine, needless to say, but I mean, let's say, here's just, there's 28 different categories that were checked, and at Dilworth Glenn and Felton, it starts out with development needed, then emerging, effective, and exemplary, and then comments. So there's kind of four, and there's 28 that were rated. In just some of the major categories, domain one had to do with planning. The teacher develops an effective instructional sequence. And then there's one, two, three main categories with things under that. Domain number two, the teacher creates and implements a physical and interpersonal classroom environment that supports student learning. And there's several things under that. The third one, the teacher engages students in learning and utilizes instructional strategies that help students understand content. And the fourth area is the teacher participates in ongoing professional development. And then with that, and that's all checked, we had to come up with a self-improvement plan. And here's mine. I mean, mine, government students will increase their score on the government entrance exit test by 50% over the semester. That's a goal now. I've never had a goal like that. And what I then have are strategies. How's that going to be measured? And resources required. And one of the resources is peer review, working on professional learning communities and all of that. As part of the presentation, which I had to go through with my principal, I had essential standards for government. There are 10 main things which all come from all of the social studies standards. So every one of my outcomes matches here. So between 9th grade and 12th grade, we cover every standard here. And then off of that, there are, for each class and each unit, essential learning outcomes. So I know how state governments around the nation are organized. I know how, and anyway, this students have to match all these, and that goes back to the standards. And then I have a test that will be given before and after with each question, and then the standard that it relates to on the social studies for the state. I have never done this before. I've taught 30-some years, and I don't know if I relate any differently to the students, but this will improve my teaching because I'm going to be more directed on outcomes and student data and all of these things. And for teachers to become part of this, I mean, I have to admit, we like to stick in our ways. We like to be in there, and, you know, having people come in and peer review, that's new. But as Mr. Olson had said earlier, we welcome that. This will make me even a better teacher and make everyone a better teacher. But some of the things that are in here that I see kind of undermining this, let's take peer review. You are moving from, right now, a team concept of evaluation And, you know, we work in social studies, we work it as a team, we're taking data, we're working to better everyone. Now, if we're, Representative Seltzer and I are fifth grade teachers, and she's been in 10 years, and I've been in 4 years, and now I'm going to do a peer review, and I know that we might be laying off a section of fifth graders this time. Boy, I don't know if I want to help her out all that much anymore. Because if my ratings can be a little higher, I might survive, keep my job. That's just one example. All of a sudden, and most, you read books on reinventing government, that they talk about, like, when you give out bonuses, you never do it individually. It's much better if you can do it by a team, because you got everyone moving up. And I could go into other, I just really think what we've got in place right now, which I voted against, is going to make a difference. It is, I know, I'm just convinced that is going to improve student achievement. I am really worried that this will be counterproductive to that and will not get to where you're going. And I'm not even putting the stuff about a 30-year veteran who, when he gets laid off with a 5-year veteran, that, you know, that's not going to be taken lightly. I don't care what type of a system is there. You know, Representative Detmer, you know. I mean, you're a vet. I mean, it's just, you're not going to take it lightly when you've been in the district 30 years and you've worked hard and no one has ever really said anything, and all of a sudden now a layoff occurs and this is going to happen. And, you know, I was the wrestling coach and happened to be a school board member, and that kid didn't wrestle one time for me because I got a little tough on my discipline or something. I mean, it's just too many things when Representative Erickson, I think you had a lot to do with this teacher evaluation system and that, which I again voted against. Yeah, and others. What I have seen when I've gone through it, this thing will work. Don't mess it up. That's all I ask, Madam Chair. Don't mess it up. I think House File 2, the portion on the layoffs, is going to be counterproductive and is actually going to hinder the student achievement I see that can be gained by this new teacher evaluation system. So, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm going to start first with the most positive note, which is that you have changed your mind on another bill, and so I hope you will change your mind on this one. It could happen. And, you know, again, there's a lot of concern about things. You know, well, what if we use this evaluation system for something that has real consequences? Well, you know, I just point to what's already in the standard for the evaluations for the model was that, you know, if, just again quoting from its page 15, lines 0.32, starting in the bill, that it comes from the Statute 122A.40, Subdivision 8, which has to do with the development, evaluation, and peer coaching for continuing contract teachers, talks about in your evaluation you must give teachers not meeting professional teaching standards under Clauses 3 through 11 support to improve. Very important, and I think you highlighted that. Absolutely, it needs to do that. And we'll continue, but also mentions discipline for teachers not making adequate progress in the teacher improvement process under Clause 12. And you mentioned that, you know, that takes some time, and yes, I agree it should. And we're not talking about, you know, people going through evaluations and, you know, the next day the pink slip arrives in the mail. But we are also talking about situations that arise where districts are forced to make decisions. And they're forced to make, you know, decisions for, you know, the next few months, the coming school year, based upon budgets or student enrollment projections that are not as they had hoped or predicted, or consolidations. And in those situations, while we all want teachers to be given good mentors and peer review and professional development and coaching to further develop and become terrific teachers, districts are also going to have to make these tough decisions. And in my opinion, I've mentioned this before as a point of the bill, that decision should be, what can we do that is in the best interest of our students? So it may be in your best interest to continue on your improvement plan, and that would be great if we can keep everybody in there. But if we can't do that, that forces some difficult decisions. And should those evaluations be part of it? I think it is. If you know you can only keep some teachers, should somebody who has been subject to some of those suggestions for discipline, should that be a factor at all in decisions of who stays or who must be put on unrequested leave? Again, let me go back to emphasize. The point of the bill here is not to try to punish teachers, to find a way to get, you know, lesser performing teachers, you know, out of your district. It is saying we have a difficult problem on our hands. We cannot keep all the teaching staff we currently have. So what are we going to do about that? And how can we make decisions to keep the best teachers possible for fulfilling the programs that we want our students to have to cover those needs for our student population? And again, I don't think any of this takes away from the spirit of continuing to improve and support our teachers. And that is not the intent of the legislation at all.
And Representative Mariani, you're the last one on the list before we move to amendments.
Well, thank you. I'll try to be real brief. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your calling on me. Chair Loon, just very quickly, on Representative Marquardt said, I'm not going to repeat it because I basically argued the same point on Thursday night last week. I think there is a difference. I do. Between the existing system, which presupposes that there will be a process by which professional development will have its time to be able to achieve maximizing that professional's ability in the classroom. And I think it's absolutely appropriate that in existing TD statute language, it says, and at some point, you know, you got to cut bait here. You know, the person has not, you know, moved forward, may have even refused to move forward. You know, that seems logical, that seems fair, and that, I think, means that everyone participating in this collaborative TDE system will give it its best in terms of offering a collaborative advice. With the UELA, with the layoff situation, we've now preempted that period of time. Even the school boards, when they testified, argued that, you know, if we're going to do this, we ought to at least delay this for a little period of time to allow this, you know, still new system to play itself out. Something for you to think about. But my point really is this, that a lot here rides on how we use the TD&E in any given system and how that matches up with the expectations in the bill, with those effectiveness, you know, ratings, et cetera. I have angst over that, but my message around that for you, the chair of the Finance Committee, is that we have 250 school districts in this state that are not QCOMP districts. In other words, we have 250 school districts that don't have a steady source of resources to make a really mature, powerful TD&E system to play itself out. And quite frankly, my school district is one of them. They made a foolish decision not to be part of it, but that's a whole other issue. But most of them are located in greater Minnesota. In other words, these are districts that really don't have, you know, the sort of infrastructure, you know, in small school districts to be able to do this. We did the one-year funding last year. I would hope, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I would hope that this committee will wrestle with that issue in the coming weeks here. I think that's a far bigger issue for us to be dealing with than this issue. I'm not putting down your effort. But we're really talking about a handful of teachers, where here we're talking about 250 school districts and their ability to carry out the full power of this TD&E system. And so that's just sort of my appeal to you and to members of this committee for us to pay attention to how we properly resource our TD&E framework in the state.
And thank you, Representative Mariani. And I was going to give you the honor, but Representative Newton wooed me into being the final word. So I'm sorry. Representative Newton, you get the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it you know, has nothing to do with finance. It's just a question. When I look on page 17, and it talks about that it gives flexibility to the school board in terms of laying off it's a sentence that starts on 17, 18, and goes to 1722. And it talks, you know, gives the school board the flexibility in terms of laying people off. I think in Anoka Hennepin, where we recently closed three of our 28 elementary schools, would this give a school board, Minneapolis has done that a few years ago as well, would it give the school board the flexibility to determine that all of the teachers in that school are laid off without having to go through the turmoil of inserting the more senior teachers back into other schools in the district? And it's just a question. I don't know if that's implied in this or not.
And just quickly, Ms. Glover, I think we can thank you. And Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Newton, let me make sure that I'm understanding your question accurately. So you're wondering if a school district decided to close a school.
Yes.
And that, and I would perhaps, I want to clarify to make sure that I'm correct on this with non-partisan staff, but if that would be the same as basically a consolidation. So your district would be reducing the number of schools within its purview. And I believe, again, whatever the locally negotiated plan of that district would be would apply in this situation as well.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just wondering if that is a possibility when schools are closed and it's not considered a consolidation by the board, that maybe that is something that has to be a part of the negotiations. But a lot of times you don't think about that. You don't think about your schools closing. You think about trying to get additional students. Thank you.
And Representative Loon, just so I follow the loops, did you want to ask nonpartisan staff about the question? Are you okay?
I'll leave that to your discretion, Mr. Chair.
I think we have enough information.
Okay.
Right, so, with that, yes.
Just if I could, I wanted to thank Representative Mariani for his comments as well, and just to, I just wanted to make sure that he didn't miss something. He mentioned the fact that the school boards and that had asked for more time on this, and just so no member is not clear about this, my author's amendment today did push out the effectiveness date by a year. So everyone will have been through the full 3 years with the summative evaluation before this would take effect. So I just want to make sure members are all clear about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loon. And with that, we'll move on to Representative Bennett's amendment, the A-15 amendment. Representative Bennett, you can stay there.
Thank you.
We appreciate your efforts, but I think we can...
All righty. Get a little exercise. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and I would like to present this to the committee.
And Representative Bennett, would you like to move your amendment?
I would like to move it. Thank you.
Representative moves her amendment to your amendment.
All righty. This amendment actually directs the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators to refuse or revoke a teacher's license without the right to receive a hearing. And under these circumstances, if the person is convicted of a felony for specific crimes, and I'll read those crimes, first and second degree sex trafficking, engaging in or agreeing to hire a minor to engage in prostitution, soliciting children to engage in sexual conduct or communicating sexually explicit materials to children, interfering with privacy, stalking a minor victim, and other offenses requiring the individual to register as a predatory offender. And from what I understand, these areas were chosen actual circumstances that have come up to the Board of Teaching before. So what this does is it would make it so that they would not require a hearing for these things, saving time for the Board of Teaching and making it absolutely impossible for these people to become teachers or have a teacher's license. So I guess it's pretty straightforward. I'll just, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions
and
or...
Representative Loon, to the amendment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be supportive of the amendment. I believe this is actually a request coming from the Board of Teaching. They have asked that they not have to provide a hearing for people seeking one over the question of the revocation of their licensure, and I think it makes a great deal of sense. I would be supportive.
So at this point, members, Representative Loon would accept the amendment. Any questions to the amendment before we vote? Any questions to the amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the member, excuse me, all those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bennett, Mr. Chair, could I ask Representative Bennett a question?
Representative Murphy.
Representative Bennett, is this a separate bill?
Representative Bennett.
Originally?
Yes.
It was a separate bill, but we're now, I'm choosing to add it as an amendment with Chair Loon's permission to House File 2.
Representative Murphy, do you have a follow-up?
And then, Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, then are you going to ask for House File 500? Is it 500? To come back to?
No.
Representative Bennett.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Are you going to?
Excuse me.
Representative Murphy, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if this goes on in this committee, then will you, in the next few days, ask to recall House File 500 to be returned to the author?
Representative Bennett, is that? I think what she's asking, so if this gets added on as an amendment, are you also going to pursue your House file that's separate? Is that correct, Representative Murphy? Do I have that correct?
That's correct.
Representative Bennett. Okay.
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bennett, or I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Okay. And with that, if there's no further questions, all those in favor of the A15 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment carries. And with that, we're on the bill. Representative Loon, if you'd like to make some final comments before we go to vote.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be just really brief because I think we've had some good discussion about a lot of things, both within the bill and kind of surrounding the bill. So let me first again reiterate that the overall goal of House File 2 is to promote more excellent qualified teachers in our classrooms. And to try to do that through some common sense things and directives to the Board of Teaching and the promulgation of their rules on things we have already asked them to do, looking at reciprocity with other states, alternative pathways for licensure and that. And again, I think overall, with some of the author's amendment and things I've done, I think hopefully there's a little more agreement on some of the areas in that those provisions of the bill. And secondly, with regards to the other portion of the bill, the unrequested leave of absence, again, emphasizing that a lot of discussion is focused around the teacher development and evaluation processes, which it sounds like some of us came from different places on that when it was first brought up as a concept and eventually passed into law. But I think we've all agreed, and we've heard even from people who are opposed to House File 2, that that is a really important tool and critical to the improvement and continued growth and improvement of our teaching staff and for the benefit of our children. So I really see House File 2 as building upon that and not something that would take away from that very important tool. And thirdly, one of my goals in serving in the new capacity that I do of this committee, but also in the education issues that I look at, I'm trying not to put mandates and a one-size-fits-all process on our districts. They usually come in and tell me they don't appreciate those things, and I know that to be true, at least for my own district. And so to try to build on the flexibility of those districts to create their own teacher evaluation process, I also think that they should be creating their own unrequested leave process. Now, we may have disagreements among the people in this committee or in this room or within the legislature on whether or not the seniority system is something that works in the best interest of our students and in this process. I don't happen to think that it does, and so I think this is a better way to go. But it also doesn't provide a mandated one-size-fits-all approach to having a little more thoughtful and locally negotiated decision-making process that works for the best interests of our students in an unrequested leave situation. So, I appreciate the members' questions. Again, I hope you know from the transition from policy to this committee, I do listen to concerns that are brought forward. I've tried to address as many of those that I felt that I could and still preserve sort of the integrity of what I'm hoping to accomplish through House File 2. And I would very much appreciate your support.
And thank you, Representative Loon, for that. Members, any other additional comments? Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, this is a very important bill, and for that reason, I'd like to request a roll call vote, please.
Representative Peterson requests a roll call vote. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have a document at the beginning of the meeting this evening when we reconvened. I asked for someone from the Board of Teaching, and they are not here, but someone has handed to me a Minnesota Board of Teaching response to House File 2, January 16th, 2015. And I know that's before your amendment, but Madam Chair, but under unnecessary rulemaking, they say, the requirement for the board to engage in rulemaking is one that also requires a great deal of staff engagement and is not without significant fiscal impact. That being said, and that this is the Finance Committee, and we heard that this is going to have local impact on school districts, and committee member Dabney spoke about a local impact fiscal notes, and I tend to agree with him. But we still don't have a fiscal note. But this is a fiscal committee, and usually the process is to go from here, and with what the testimony that author Chair Loon gave with an amendment, it does have an additional fiscal impact. At some point in time, then, it should appear before Ways and Means. But we also received testimony earlier in the day that talked about data practices, and Ms. Glover again talked about the impact on data privacy and litigation with data privacy. So I would like to renew my statement that I feel strongly that the Civil Law Committee should hear that. And so I asked the author of the bill to change her language on the motion to go to civil law and then back to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I know we're just about to go on to the roll call, but Representative Loon, would you take the considerations of Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. Well, let me back up and share with the committee in the point after which we recessed and before we reconvened. I did meet with the chair of the Civil Law Committee and discussed with her House File 2 and whether or not she would like to see it, felt it should be seen, and she did not see a reason to have it referred. So I did discuss this with her. And then with regards to the financial believed to be any financial impact or fiscal note, just again to clarify, I want to make sure I wasn't there was a question or a dialogue about the Board of Teaching and their request coming through the governor's budget and for additional funds. I think that was not pertinent necessarily to this bill. It was in general they're asking for more money for the next biennium. And so my comments were with regards to that, but indicating that would be a consideration when we prepare a bill because they've just asked for more money in general. With regards to something that would specifically trigger a potential fiscal note was the licensure by portfolio, which I've already referenced and taken that out. So I don't see it. I appreciate the spirit in which you're asking it, and like I said, certainly I can give it more thought, but I from the information I have currently, I don't believe it would be necessary.
And with that, thank you, Representative Loon. With that, Representative Loon renews her motion to send House File 2 as amended to the General Register. Ms. Kynes, if you'd take the roll call.
Representative Loon?
Aye.
Representative Kresha?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Anza?
No.
Representative Bennett?
Yes.
Representative Christensen?
Yes.
Representative Dabney?
No.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Erickson?
Yes.
Representative Fenton?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Mallory is absent, I believe. Representative Newton?
No.
Representative Norris?
Yes.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Kwong?
See.
Representative Seltzer?
No.
And Representative Slocum is absent. Representative Wills?
Yes.
Thank you. Members, in the vote tally of 13 ayes and 7 nays, the ayes have it, and the motion, and the ayes have it, and the motion prevails. House File 2 is on its way to the General Register. House File 2, as amended, is sent to the General Register. And with that, members, this committee stands adjourned.